www.thebigblue.org.
I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here today on the big program. Our good friend, attorney Irwin Aronson, going to be here talking about employee misclassification. A story coming out of Utah recently shows that the construction industry basically decimated by this concept of the independent contractor. You're your own boss. Yes, you carry all the risk. You pay all the taxes. You pay all the workers' comp, the unemployment. Basically shifting all the risk, all the responsibility onto the backs of the individual, while the corporate form, well, they reap all the benefits. And we'll be interested to talk to him. In the second hour, Travis Waldron's going to be here from the Center for American Progress, Think Progress blog, on the possibility that today, and the stories are out that today, Richard Cordray, the guy that Obama wants to head up the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, may be recessed appointed. Also, maybe the titanium spine that Michelle Bachmann talked about, maybe as she left the race, maybe she handed it off to Obama, because there's a chance, I'm being told, that there'll be some recess appointments to the NLRB, which will allow that agency to actually do its job. So we'll be interested to find out about that. Also in the second hour, Teamsters International Vice President Brian Baiuli is going to be here. He's talking about what's going on in Indiana. We've been talking about this right to work for less legislation that the Republicans want to ram down our throat. And Indiana is the next battleground where they're going to attempt to steal workers' rights. So it'll be interesting to talk to Brian Baiuli from the Teamsters Union. And in the third hour, Jacqueline Friedman, author of the book Yes Means Yes, going to be here talking about the assault on women's rights by the radical right. I mean, you saw Santorum come out, say, well, you know, the states should be able to outlaw birth control. Which is, you know, understand, I've been telling you this for the longest time. They don't really care that much about Roe. It's more about Griswold. But, you know, it's under there. It's the undercurrent of the radical right. And then Gingrich comes out and says, well, I'm against abortion no matter what now, even in cases of rape and incest. And his rationale, well, we'll set up an agency where they can dump the children and we'll shuffle them around. And that will give them a little counseling too. So that'll be interesting conversations. Also, your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. So last night, the big night, I don't know that Iowa really resolved anything. I think we already knew what was going to happen. Romney was going to probably come out on top. Santorum would show very well, and the Paul Botts would come out in numbers. You knew that. You knew an evangelical was going to come out. You knew Romney was going to come out. You knew crazy was going to come out. Well, actually, crazy came out across the board. But, you know, Romney, he took the pie by a whopping, 8 votes. Karl Rove was wrong. He was expecting 14. But, you know, they had to do some shuffling in after-hours work. But Santorum, he's going to have his moment of glory. This is going to be his moment in the sun. And what I find really interesting, the Well, one, the guy doesn't even have his own bus. That should tell you something about the state of his campaign and the fact that he doesn't have any money. And maybe this will inject some capital into his campaign. I doubt it, really, especially after last night, losing the opportunity to probably pick up a couple million bucks. They didn't bother to update his website. I mean, he doesn't even have a staff to do that. Now they're like, you know what? Never mind. Wait till morning. And then what they write, and this is one of those things that caught my eye, they write that Rick Santorum, the only conservative who can beat Mitt Romney. And he didn't beat Romney. And last time I checked, my idea of what is winning and what is losing, I think is still correct. If you lose by 8, you lost. But this is politics, and you know the Iowa caucus, I guess you can declare victory whenever you want. And that's what Santorum is doing. What I find amazing, though, is that Santorum didn't have his own bus. The rumor is that he had to borrow the family van or family bus of Billy Bob Duggar, who endorsed him. You know, the one with 19 kids. You got to borrow the bus from a reality TV show to get around the state. Kind of interesting. At a time when you've got someone like Rupert Murdoch, who says that he supports Santorum. Wouldn't you get a little cash out of Murdoch? Wouldn't Murdoch pony up a couple of bucks? Especially in a time when you're talking about an election cycle that's paid for by the billionaire class to begin with. And Romney, he's out declaring landslide victory. McCain, who's come out and endorsed him, said that was a landslide. You know, he got 6 votes less this time than he got last time. So McCain comes out and he endorses Romney and says, you know, Romney's going to lead from the front on foreign policy. And I'm not really sure what that means. Does it mean that he's going to be like Santorum, and anytime something pops up, we should just bomb them? I mean, is that leading from the front? I actually think Obama's done a fairly good job on foreign policy. He's poked his nose in where he should. He stayed out of where he should. I'm not happy with Afghanistan or Iraq, but I kind of understand it. I would have liked to have seen that end quicker. But this idea that we're going to lead from the front on foreign policy just sounds jingoistic and, well, very Republican. And it speaks to that low-information voter who just wants to puff out his chest and pound his chest and say, oh, I'm number one. It kind of makes me think of that. The one place I do guarantee Romney, if elected president, would lead, and I absolutely believe this hands down, he will lead from the front in handing out more special breaks to corporations. He will make sure that his buddies at Bain and the Wall Street cronies that are funding his campaign, they will be in the front of the line. They will get the first dibs on what is available. And you and I, well, we're not going to get anything because they're not going to leave anything. They're like vultures. And I find it fairly ironic that you're going to have someone like McCain come out and say, well, you know, he's going to lead from the front. And as I was watching McCain give his speech, it was one of these things that just catches my attention. He was saying, well, you know, the world thinks we're weak and the world thinks we're this. And, you know, we're leading from behind, but we're a great country and we're number one. And, you know, the jingoism, but he's trying to destroy Obama. He's trying to tear Obama down by saying he's taking us downward while simultaneously saying we're number one, which I don't know that you can really do. Can you? I mean, is that possible? Is it possible to take both positions at once, that we're faltering and we're on the downslide because of Obama, but yet we're number one? I mean, is that logical? I don't think so. But interesting stuff, interesting numbers. I mean, when you look at it, you had Romney got over 30,000, Santorum got over 30,000 votes. And really, I mean, stop and think about it. We're basing the most powerful man in the world, who, if elected, will be the number one guy, on 30,000 votes in a very small state. Just caught my attention. Ron Paul got 26,000. Gingrich in fourth got about a little over 13% of the vote, 16,000. Perry came in and, well, a distant kind of fifth. Who he is now going back to Texas and reassessing his campaign. I don't quite know what that means. There were some photos of him being tweeted around of him out jogging, saying he was heading to South Carolina. Because I got to tell you, he needs to stay out of New Hampshire. He doesn't stand a chance. There aren't enough crazy evangelicals there, which is why Bachman dropped out of this whole thing. She looked at the tea leaves and said, Iowa was my place. I bought the straw poll, which gave me a little bit of credibility, gave me some national airtime, and I came in a distant sixth with just 5%. So I think she read the leaves and said, there's no more money coming. There's no more time on TV. I'm going to have to pack it in. And she did. And she did it in a very weird way. I mean, it's kind of interesting. She said something along the lines that I'm going to protect for I'm going to fight to protect life for the right to a natural death. And I'm going, what exactly is a natural death? Here's what she said.
I'll fight to protect life from conception until natural death.
Does that mean when you send people off to war, is that a natural death? When you send people off to the electric chair or to the needle or wherever, are those natural deaths? So is she going to fight for those people too? I don't think so. But it was kind of interesting. Her whole little speech was just, if you saw it today, it was really weird. But then again, we are talking about Michelle Bachman, who had some very, very bizarre things to say. I mean, the first half of it was some weird kind of idea of history where she just read poorly what someone else had obviously written. And I found it disturbing. I mean, on such a visceral level, I'm going, this woman could have been president at one point. There are people who voted for her. There are what, some 6,000 people in the state of Iowa who voted for her. She got 5% of the vote. And, you know, rational people, I like John Huntsman as a Republican. He only got 745 votes. Now, there are a bunch of things about him that I think are way off base, but I think he's at least rational. If you look at the voting numbers, though, what I found funny is that the lizard people got 5 votes. So had Santorum been able to tap in to his inner lizard, he may have been able to swing this thing. You know, lizard picked up a Pastafarian or two. Maybe he'd have done all right. But this thing with Bachman today, it was really spooky. She went on this weird little rant. Well, here it is.
I will fight to legalize American energy production. I will fight for American families. I'll fight to protect life from conception until natural death,
yeah,
to protect traditional marriage. And I'll fight to secure our borders. And I'll fight to protect religious liberty. I'll fight for this country and for the American people every day in the way that God allows me to.
Yeah, I mean, had she maybe talked about that more during her campaign, maybe somebody would have maybe thought about her. And what I found funny is right at the very beginning, she steps up to the podium. This is what she says.
Thank you, everyone, for being here. I appreciate it. My name is Michelle Bachman.
When you're holding a press conference and you have to step to the microphone and identify yourself, it's no wonder she lost. It's no wonder she did very poorly. So I'm really, it's a sad day here at the program because I really, going to New Hampshire next week, really wanted an opportunity to meet the myth, the legend. I really wanted to have, just 5 minutes with her to see the depths of the insanity, and now I'm being cheated. That is being taken from me by the voters of Iowa, and I'm very unhappy with the folks of Iowa because they should have voted for her. Rick Santorum stole her piece of the pie. And what's he going to do with it is the question. I mean, is he going to be able to turn this into something that's going to get him a couple of votes out of New Hampshire? That's yet to be seen. He's going to get crushed in New Hampshire. Everybody says that. And I think it's going to happen. I think he avoids New Hampshire. He heads to South Carolina where he may have a shot. And that's going to be, I think, one of his last stands because if he doesn't get a boatload of money out of this, he's in big trouble. And where the boatload of money should have come from was his staff putting up last night around 9 o'clock. Hey, we won big. Give us money so we can continue to take this on. One of those things. But what's now kind of interesting to me, though, is you may start to see an alliance going after Romney. And Gingrich, who yesterday called him a liar, maybe one of those people leading up this charge to, hey, let's start an alliance. He was interviewed by Laura Ingraham today, and he said there's a possibility. Him and Tricky Ricky Santorum, who have been friends for 20 years, they're both rebels, he said. This may be very interesting. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. Right back after this with our good friend, Attorney Irwin Aronson. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We want the world and we want it now. We're going to take it anyhow. We want the hellwind.
Not right wing. Just right. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Some politicians are playing politics, pushing a so-called right-to-work law. This law is an attack on working people and does nothing to create jobs. We need our leaders to stop targeting workers and start working to fix our economy.
Indiana Republicans are trying to push through a so-called right-to-work law aimed at weakening workers' union rights. Indiana AFL-CIO spokesperson Jeff Harris says Republicans are locking Hoosiers out of their statehouse while they carry out their attack on working families.
As the legislature goes into session, we will try to have people enter the statehouse, and there will be thousands of people outside the statehouse trying to get in. It's designed literally by the 1% to attack the 99%. Right to work is about taking unions down. Organized labor is the last great voice standing in opposition to total corporate control, and that's what they're going after. It stood strong last year. We fought not only right to work, but onslaught of other anti-worker bills, and we are going to try to do our best again. But the tactics that we're seeing in Indiana, like we saw in Wisconsin, are just chilling.
The Indiana AFL-CIO says if this deceptively titled right-to-work legislation is passed, it will have a wide-ranging and overwhelmingly negative impact on workers' wages, safety conditions, and rights on the job. Cooper Tire workers in Findlay, Ohio, are on day 40 of being locked out of their production plant. Jesse Russell reports.
More than 1,000 workers are being denied work due to an inability to reach a new contract agreement. The last time the company sat down with the United Steelworkers Union, which represents the employees at the plant, was on December 13th. This weekend, Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown met with the employees to tell them he would do everything he can to get them back to work, and he called what Cooper was doing unfair.
Productivity of American workers continues to go up. Corporate profits continue to go up, yet wages are stagnant, and that's a shrinking middle class.
No new dates have been set for negotiations, but a federal mediator is scheduled to begin setting up discussions the week of January 11th.
During the Rose Bowl parade this week, a Wisconsin marching band stopped and broke into its rendition of the 1940 Woody Guthrie pro-labor song, Union Made. Commentators were clueless that the band was making a pro-union statement.
They just stopped in the middle of this band, and they're just getting down.
They just said, you only get to this parade every so often, we're going to have some fun. Look at, they're doing their stuff. They think it's halftime.
This is a halftime performance. Are you kidding me?
This newscast made possible in part by Ulico, the Union Labor Life Insurance Company. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Standing up to conservatives and corporatists every weeknight, The Rick Smith Show.
I'm just an average man with an average life. I work from 9 to 5. Hey, hell, I pay the price. All I want is to be left alone in my average home. But why do I always feel
back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. I think it's going to be a whole day of depression for me. Michelle Bachmann dropping out of the race. And I guess, you know, when you step up to the microphone on the day that you're going to announce that you're getting out of the race, and this is what you say?
Thank you, everyone, for being here. I appreciate it. My name is Michelle Bachmann.
When you have to announce at your own press conference that who you are and why you're stepping down, probably explains why you are stepping down. Anyway, I came across this this story by Steve Cooper over at WePartyPatriots.com, and it's an excellent piece. I suggest it. He's talking about worker misclassification in the building trades and the construction industry out in Utah, and it was one of these things that go, you know, this is the road we're heading down. And what kind of struck me as funny, or maybe not funny, but probably why the local news covered it there in Utah, is that it was the local contractors, the owners of the businesses who are no longer getting the work, who were complaining that they were being undercut by these misclassified workers. And I thought it an interesting topic, and that's why I've asked our good friend, Attorney Erwin Aronson, to come talk to us a bit about Utah and how it could affect us here in Pennsylvania. Erwin, thanks for taking time for me.
Good to be here.
How was your holiday?
Our holidays were just wonderful. What could be bad about being with family and close friends and reflecting on the real desires we all have, a world with peace and without the exploitation of workers?
Yeah,
and we get to do that.
It was a wonderful holiday in the Smith household as well.
Good.
You know, with small children, it's always fantastic. You know, but I look at this, and the story that came out from Utah, they quoted one of the contractors who said, you know, we used to get 30-35% of our bids. Now we're getting maybe 5% because there's an agency out there that's telling every individual contractor that you could be your own boss, start your own company. And these other contractors are mandating that these people do this. And still making them do what they're supposed to do, still giving them orders, making them wear uniforms, following their rules, but they're magically, because of this new title, they're no longer their employees.
Well, it is most charitably described as an outrage, and it's not as if this is new. The only thing that is new about this is that it is now refined from being an under-the-table, cynical, underhanded, painfully illegal effort at twisting people into a new business model that's acceptable in places like Utah, and I fear acceptable in places like Pennsylvania, with one asterisk. And the asterisk is that these people are using this in one extra cynical way, and that extra cynical way is to evade the E-Verify system that applies to hiring employees but doesn't apply to hiring contractors or vendors. And so when they make these unsuspecting, exploited people into vendors instead of the true employees that they are, they also evade the E-Verify language. And I promise you beyond peradventure that these are among the same people that are still beating that jingoistic anti-immigrant drum that we hear so loudly emanating from some of the most conservative political circles.
Right. You know, and I looked at this and I'm going, you know, at the end of the road, where if we allow it to happen in the construction industry, when does it happen in every industry? When is it now you're your own boss, you're an independent contractor, but you still, like FedEx, have to wear my uniform and drive my labeled equipment and you have to follow my rules? When does it affect everybody?
It's affecting everybody right now, Rick. It came out as a story about the construction industry in Utah this week. But it's a story that has existed in the Pennsylvania construction industry for decades. I've interfaced with it. I've interacted with it a number of years ago in a slightly different context. And the context was not to simply evade payroll taxes and workers' compensation liability and unemployment compensation liability and Social Security liability, but to evade the Pennsylvania Prevailing Wage Act, somebody started a company that was called Knights Electric, K-N-I-G-H-T, apostrophe S, Electric. And it was allegedly modeled after the Knights of Labor, a precursor to our own AFL-CIO in today's jargon. And everybody was a so-called independent contractor because independent contractors, of course, are not covered by the Prevailing Wage Act. So Knights Electric would contract to do public work and then reassign the work to individuals who they controlled. And we caught them and chased them down and ultimately broke that up. But that wasn't this week or last week or even in 2011. That was probably 16, 17 years ago. So this is new only in character, because now with the advent of the so-called LLCs, limited liability corporations, what we have is, instead of an out-and-out overt lie where we call an employee an independent contractor, we have this new fiction where we have these employees become members of the limited liability corporation. So they're in effect partners in a business, but each partner is responsible for her or his own independent economic aspect of that, including but not limited to filing tax returns. Intriguingly, this is much more based on attempting to evade the Internal Revenue Code and the regulations promulgated under the Internal Revenue Code than it is to deal with any state law issues, because the Internal Revenue Service many years ago published a 20-part test for determining whether or not someone is an independent contractor. And you have, as you always do so intelligently, focused, among other things, on some of the elements of that 20-part test. Who controls the work? How are they controlled? What must they do? Who determines the hours? Who determines the days? Who owns the tools and the equipment? Who sets the sequence of work? And things of that nature, all of which are elements that the Internal Revenue Service uses to determine whether somebody's an independent contractor. And what these people in Utah, or at least that we are aware of in Utah, I suspect that they're operating in other places, many other places as well, have done to attempt to evade, or using their words, overcome the legal requirements, is to not have these people be called independent contractors, but to call them members of an LLC or limited liability corporation. And instead of giving them the classic 1099 form from the IRS at the end of the year telling them how much they earn, they give them what is known as a K-1, and also an IRS form. The K-1 is regarding a partner's share of income from a partnership. And in doing that, they attempt to evade the Internal Revenue Service. It is my fervent hope that the Internal Revenue Service will chase these things down and deal with them, because just like so many situations, it's not when we merely find out that workers are being exploited that the investigatory process crops up. It's when businesses are feeling that their ox is being gored because they're trying to operate in a legitimate or quasi-legitimate fashion, and they're getting beaten up by a system that they have caused or acquiesced in existing.
I was reading through the story, they weren't talking to these individual workers who are getting screwed in this. What they were talking to is the business owners who were now going, I've created this monster and it's coming after me.
Yeah, well, they did actually talk to one worker and made sure that they mentioned in the piece that the worker they talked to answered the questions in Spanish. And that spoke volumes, because that made the point I was trying to far less artfully make a few moments ago, when I recognized that this is happening not merely for the purpose of exploiting workers, but also for the purpose of exploiting people who are immigrants, people who are ostensibly the object of the ire and enmity of the very people who are exploiting them. So it's very poignant that the one person that they spoke to who was being a victim of all of this happened to be of Hispanic descent and apparently not a native English speaker.
Yeah, and what I found interesting, in looking at Utah is one of those states, you know, that did away with their prevailing wage. They're a right-to-work state. All of these things that... Here we see a fraction of the Republican Party wanting to pursue. And I look at this and I go, is this our future as an industry? And as you've pointed out, I didn't know, it's already here.
Yeah. Well, listen, it's been here in another industry for decades as well, and that's in the trucking industry, yeah, where I remember as far back as the early 1970s, the over-the-road trucking companies were making many, many of the drivers so-called independent owner-operators. And they sunk their teeth into the guys in a very terrible and very ugly way by first hiring them into jobs, then telling them the job was going to go away, but they could buy the tractor from the company at outrageous interest rates and over an outrageous term, and they, of course, wouldn't be permitted to accept any assignments to take over-the-road hauls for anybody other than the company that sold them the tractor and was financing the tractor.
Yeah, one of my favorite stories, when MS Carriers was around, I talked to one of their drivers who was telling me at the time, this was about 8 years ago, he was working for 23 cents a mile. And he, at the time, the industry standard was about 39 cents a mile.
Yeah.
He was working for 23 cents a mile, and he said, in 7 years, that truck out there is going to be mine.
Yeah.
And I said, yeah, in 7 years, you're going to have over a million miles, and it's not going to be worth anything.
Yeah, exactly.
But again, you know, he really bought into the sales pitch, and it really is one of a very American kind of sales pitch. You're going to be your own boss. You're going to control your own destiny. You're going to be the man.
Well, you know, it's a very American kind of something, but sadly, it's not a sales pitch. It is exploitation on steroids. And in times of economic distress, like we have experienced for the last 3.5 years. That type of exploitation not merely rears its ugly head, but takes over and becomes somehow acceptable. And that's really the biggest trouble of all that we have as a society, where this form of exploitation becomes an acceptable norm instead of an unacceptable and repugnant action for which the perpetrators are to be prosecuted. We have a much bigger and much more essential problem, and that's what this is truly about, Rick.
And I would say it's the broken nature of our labor laws and the poor enforcement of the fuel that we have.
Yeah, well, it absolutely is. It is very clear. This is when we say that this is uniquely American. What is uniquely American about it is that we don't find this in Canada, just across the border from the United States. We don't find it in Western Europe. We don't find it even in Eastern Europe. This is special. This is the Maquita Doris story of Mexico of 10 years ago, 12 years ago, and this is the America of not only the 2012s, but also the America of the 1812s and of the 1912s. And that's what's breathtaking about it, the amount of progress we like to believe we've made. And the short cycle in which the exploiters can become the agents provocateur, and when an unemployed person steals a loaf of bread for his family or her children, that person is deemed to be a criminal. And when somebody who produces absolutely nothing comes up with a new corporate enterprise that is aimed at legitimizing, if you will, the exploitation of working folks, that's somehow called good business.
He's an entrepreneur.
He's an entrepreneur who has no investment in anything and has a huge return on the investment that he does make.
Yeah. You know, yesterday we talked to a guy from the Canadian Auto Workers Union up in London, Ontario.
I listened to the
lead segment. Negotiator for the folks at Caterpillar. And he told me, and to highlight what you were saying about the laws, up there in Canada, they've got a law that says if a foreign company buys one of their companies, the purchase has to benefit the country.
Yeah.
And I found that just in this country, that would be heresy, according to the Republicans, or some Democrats too. But it just highlights the fact that our laws are kind of skewed in one direction.
Our laws are skewed in one direction. And with all due respect, and I don't want to be misquoted or mischaracterized here, but laws like NAFTA, are not laws that were in their genesis, Republican alone. They were supported and advocated by Democrats as well. This is a piece of political, economic, social, and historic fantasy that needs to be recognized for what it has been and what it continues to be. This is a blight on our country.
So what's the answer, Irwin? I mean, at some point, don't the working people of this country have to wake up to the fact that, you know, and I agree with you, there's really one party in this country. It's the Green Party, and not the environmental Green Party. It's the money party.
That's right. That's right.
What's it going to take for us to wake up?
I think what it takes for us is not to wake up. We have awakened. The question is what we do with that awakening. There was a wonderful book that became a Broadway play a couple of years ago called Spring Awakening. It may be time, really, for an American spring where we just collectively say it's enough. The Occupy movement has certainly been a start of that, but it's not the end, and we need to deal with this. We need to do things like pass statutory actions that will enjoy constitutional muster that undo this insanity called Citizens United that makes this the Green Party country,
right,
that encourages not merely unbridled political contributions, but hidden political contributions in these so-called IRS Section 527 committees that can collect and expend money without ever identifying who the contributors were, and not have that be limited to voluntary contributions, but really come right out of corporate treasuries. That needs to be dealt with so that we have some meaningful limitations. You cited Canada and our brother from the CAW who was on yesterday. In Canada, a campaign for premier begins and ends in the course of about 6 weeks. Yesterday, we had the first completed volley in a U.S. presidential campaign that's already been going on for a year and has nearly a year to go. And we're not talking about thousands of dollars being spent, or even hundreds of thousands of dollars, or even millions of dollars. We're looking at a presidential campaign that's going to expend $1 billion, that's with a B, dollars. And when there's that much money involved in seeking political office, there is some chicanery that inevitably must take place.
Right.
And it's not about Democrats or about Republicans. It's about the people of this country versus the special interests of this country.
Last question I've got for you. Are you optimistic at all about what's the direction that we're heading, that come next November we're going to maybe see some rational change? I mean, I understand, you know, maybe President Obama took Michelle Bachmann's titanium spine, talking about a couple of recess appointments today. Hasn't happened yet, but not yet that I understand, but it's possible.
Well, I think it's quite possible that there are going to be some recess appointments, and I think that the Obama administration has really listened to what they've been hearing from the people that sent them to Washington. And that is the development of what you refer to as the titanium spine. We are seeing action now. We have the President of the United States of America, the occupant of a co-equal branch of government with the Congress, saying it's time to choose. It's time to choose what kind of America we are prepared to have, what kind of country we're prepared to be, what kind of people we expect our future to deliver. And if these recess appointments come to fruition, as I anticipate reasonably that they will, to not merely the National Labor Relations Board, but several other critical agencies that deal with the water we drink and the air we breathe and the environment in which we live, and the way in which we interact with safety and health issues, we will have a choice. And the people of this country really will get the opportunity to make choices. And I hope that the broad swath of candidates for Congress, at least within the president's party, sign on to the idea of this being a country that is better than what we've produced for the last several years, not one that's based on division and triangulation, but one that's based on how we move ahead as a nation, what's best for America, what's best for our economy, what's best for our children. So, yes, I am cautiously optimistic. I'm not quite up to ebullient yet, but I think that we're going to see some of the most reactionary forces in the Congress of the United States blunted or defeated.
Excellent.
And I think that we're going to see congressional campaigns that are a good bit different than they were 2 years ago.
Well, we shall see and we shall hope. Irwin, always great to talk with you. I look forward to talking to you next week.
Sounds like a great plan. Be well, be safe. And to you and the great staff at the Rick Smith Show and all who listen to us, happy, healthy, sweet, safe, and peaceful New Year.
Thanks so much. Our good friend, Attorney Irwin Aronson. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this with your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
USA, I'm taking all our money and shipping it offshore. Do the job that you're looking for.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
The powers that be constantly try to pull the wool over people's eyes. But sometimes, the wool blinders are so itchy that people rip them off and clearly see the scam. One of the itchiest ever is the Kafkaesque fiction put forth by America's right-wing power establishment that corporations are persons with the constitutional right to control our elections with their bottomless troves of corporate cash. This is an absurd perversion of nature itself. A person, after all, has a navel. Where's the corporate navel? Or its heart, brain, or soul? Also, if a corporation is a person, shouldn't it be subject to frontline military duty, to jail for its criminal violations, and even to the death penalty? As a listener pointed out to me in a recent email, many states do not allow persons under 18 years of age to marry, or, in corporate terminology, to merge. Plus, such young persons are subject to curfews and cannot legally be served alcohol. If you see a young corporation violating any of these teen laws, call the cops on them. When a corporate and governmental cabal makes such a power play that the very idea of it becomes a national joke, both the idea and the cabal are in trouble. That's the case with a comical claim of personhood for corporations. All across the country, beneath the radar of America's clueless elites, a savvy and scrappy grassroots coalition is mobilizing to overturn the anti-democratic effort by the Supreme Court, corporate front groups, and political sellouts to enthrone corporate money over the people. On January 20th and 21st, there will be two national days of action to rally public support for a constitutional amendment to reject the farce of corporate personhood. This is Jim Hightower saying, to join the rebellion, connect with www.movetoamend.org and www.democracyisforpeople.org.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Dan Kerfak, in his piece over at the New Economic Perspectives magazine, titled Public Money for Public Purposes, he says, those who are permitted to own the lion's share of wealth will always own the lion's share of the decision-making process. Since democracy consists in the equal distribution of decision-making power throughout the whole body of a self-governing people, no real democracy is possible in the presence of gross inequality of wealth. And, you know, basically saying, look, you know, you've got a handful of kingmakers. You've got a handful of people, the 1%, if you will, the 1% against the 99%, the Rupert Murdochs who fund Rick Santorum, the billionaires who fund Romney, and the billionaires who funded Perry, the casino magnates who say, oh, well, let's play this game. The natural gas and the oil people who influence policy here in the state of Pennsylvania. We can't get a rational severance tax to cover the cost of them doing business here, let alone like the socialist state of Alaska, where the good socialist Sarah Palin pushed through a payback from the oil industry to the citizens. You know, that just blows my mind how it is that Palin is somehow a conservative when she did one of the most absolute socialist things imaginable, which is to make the corporation who they pander to pay the people for taking the corporation's oil? I mean, stop and think about that here at home. They're causing environmental disasters. They're basically raping the land. And somehow they're entitled to what's under our feet. Now, they pay a little bit here to the folks who live there, but you know, pennies on the dollar. And not making this state a better place. And you know, I think to that law in Canada that we just talked about with our good friend Irwin Aronson. You got to do something that if you're going to buy a foreign company in Canada, foreign company is going to buy something here, it's got to benefit the country. And I start and I think about this, you know, isn't that what charters used to be? You used to have to say, hey, how are you going to make our state, our city, our county, our little nook of the world better by allowing you to incorporate? How are you going to do that? How's it going to make my life any better if I let XYZ Corporation operate within what I've created, the roads, the bridges, the education, the healthcare? Explain that to me. How's that going to work? And now you've seen all the wealth in the hands of a few. And what are they doing with it? Well, they're doing what they do. They're making sure that they're taken care of and basically the heck with you. And I look at this story from the Trib Review today. They're talking about Zogby. They're talking about Corbett's budget and how, you know, we're hundreds of millions of dollars. They forecasted that we would get hundreds of millions of dollars more in revenue. That's not going to happen. Now what are we going to do? Oh, geez. We need to start thinking about what we can cut. And Turd's Eye, you know, popped out with, you know, hey, you know, we need to start to close the budget gap. We might have to sell state assets, such as the state liquor system. Couldn't get that through in a Republican majority House and Senate here in Pennsylvania. But that's still on the table in his mind because we need, as the leaked Corbett memo accuses Rendell of doing, using stimulus money to plug holes and hide problems. They want to do the same thing. They want to sell our assets, though. They want to sell those things that benefit you and me. You know, I'm a kid who grew up in Cleveland. Look, I remember the 70s when the banks put the city of Cleveland into bankruptcy because Dennis Kucinich, as mayor, absolutely refused to sell Muni Light. Muni Light was a city asset that gave consumers in that city lower electric rates and provided revenue to the city. Well, the profiteers wanted that. That was a valuable asset. And Kucinich said, no, I'm not selling it. We need it. We need the revenue. And for $15 million, they put the city of Cleveland into bankruptcy. He ended up losing the next election. And I give him the ultimate credit, which is why I think he's a great guy. He took the political beating to save the city. In today's era, the politicians we have right now, not a blink would happen. They would have sold Muni Light off and said, well, I closed the budget gap. I'm a hero. Throw roses at me. And 10 years down the road, when that corporation who bought it for a pittance is gouging your eyes out, that's a problem for somebody else. Because that politician at that moment, that speck of time was the hero. You're going to suffer for that generations into the future, as we've seen with all of these privatization scams. You and I get screwed every single time. And what bothers me is the article points out one of the Democrats, Paul Costa, a Democrat who I like, good guy. He's quoted as saying, if things don't start to look better in March or April, then we have to seriously figure out what we're going to do. They're already laying the groundwork saying, well, we may have to do something. I know what you do. There's a magic box. There's this magic box in Delaware that all the profits from big corporations go through, and it's scrubbed clean. There's a box there. We could close that loophole. We could shut that box. Not going to do that. We could make the drillers pay more. Not going to do that. What are we going to do? We're going to make sure we cut programs like LIHEAP. And I don't know if you saw the Patriot News article today. The woman who's in charge of the Department of Public Welfare, a spokeswoman, Ann Bale, she said the state benefits can last through March. They've got enough money to last through March. Hopefully it doesn't get too cold. because they don't quite have enough money. And her quote was, which is when the season begins to taper off, but once the money's gone, it's gone. Which basically means, Granny, you're on your own. It gets cold at the end of March, it gets cold in April, you're on your own, honey. What does that say about us? It says we're going to make sure that the very wealthy in this country are well taken care of. But you at the bottom, you seniors, you children, you poor, screw you. That's what we're saying. Let's take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
Wednesday, January 4th, the Earth will be closest to the Sun for the year this evening, according to clocks in the U.S.
For the whole world, Earth's closest point to the Sun, called its perihelion, will come at 1 in the morning Universal Time on January 5th. Earth comes closest to the Sun every year in January during winter for the Northern Hemisphere. We're always farthest from the Sun in July during Northern Hemisphere summer.
So you can see it can't be Earth's distance from the Sun that causes the seasons. In fact, our planet has seasons because of its tilt on its axis. Earth's tilt causes the northern and southern hemispheres to trade places in receiving the Sun's light and warmth most directly as our world orbits the Sun.
Earth's closest and farthest points to the Sun don't cause the seasons, but they do affect the lengths of the seasons. When Earth is closest to the Sun for the year, as it is now, our world is moving fastest in orbit. The result is that Northern Hemisphere winters and Southern Hemisphere summers are the year's shortest seasons.
So that's our planet Earth closest to the Sun in 2012 on January 5th at hour number one, Universal Time. I'm Deborah Bird.
And I'm Jorge Salazar. Come to the Tonight area of EarthSky.org for sky charts. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
Time for change. It's time to rearrange.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
You can't tell me. We're gonna make it somehow. I heard a wise man say, revolution starts now. I think it's time for change.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at TheRickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of our program, that's the place to go to get our podcast. Or if you've got a smartphone, get the Stitcher app, and you can take the program on the go. So Michael Lind, he wrote in his book, The Next American Nation, he said, quote, from its fortified command post in the large organizations of the private sector, protected by concentric moats of alumni preference, college tuition, professional licensing, and pro-managerial state laws, the white overclass dominates U.S. politics through its predominant role in campaign financing and the staffing of key federal offices, particularly offices in high-toned executive and judicial branches. And I look at this and I go, this is exactly what I'm saying. The 1% has dictated what happens to the rest of us. This is not a democracy of, for, and by we, the people. This is of, for, and by the very, very wealthy few who are able to afford to buy politicians and to buy legislation. And to put who they want on what benches. What's amazing to me, I look at Massey Energy, the CEO they had there, that Blankenship. As has been reported, he was instrumental in getting a judge appointed to the I think it was the West Virginia Supreme Court, who then turned around and you know it was a quid pro quo, who turned around and said, well, I'm going to vote in favor of Massey Energy on this particular lawsuit, which probably saved Massey $50 million. And that's really not criminal. I mean, there's something seriously wrong with a system that allows that to happen. And for me, it all comes down to the money. It all comes down to this idea that corporations have free speech and somehow corporations are people. And I'm thrilled to see across the country, you've seen Los Angeles, Oakland, Albany, Missoula, Montana, places like Boulder, Colorado, South Miami, Florida, have all passed pieces of legislation saying, you know what? You're not people, corporations. And that they want Congress to pass an amendment overturning Citizens United. Today, the New York City Council is expected to vote on a resolution doing that exact thing. Saying, look, Congress, you've got to overturn what the Supreme Court has done. They have gone well beyond their bounds. This is a bad decision. This is a dumb decision. This is screwing up our democratic process. This is putting too much power in the hands of people who already have too much power. Now, understand, there are several pieces of legislation in the House and Senate that aim to do this. But like anything, you have to build grassroots support. I would love to see Harrisburg. I would love to see Scranton. I would love to see Allentown. I'd love to see Philadelphia. I would love to see city councils across this state say, we want Citizens United overturned. The only way we're going to save our nation is to get the money out of it. And we need to have rational campaign finance laws. And we need to, as our friend Irwin said earlier, like Canada, shorter election periods. This idea that you're running for office before you're even inaugurated, you're running for your re-election before Inauguration Day is insane. But that's exactly what happens to the people in Congress. And in the Senate every day, they're worried about where am I going to get the money? Got to get money out of it, pure and simple. And that's why I've always been in favor of publicly financed elections. You would give them, this is your money. This is all you get. Show me what you can do with this. Probably not going to happen, though. McCain came out today, as I said earlier, and has endorsed Romney. Romney, the guy who believes that corporations are people, which, again, you know, this is who you're voting for.
Corporations are people, my friend. We can raise taxes on... Of course they are. Everything corporations earn ultimately goes to people.
Right. So this kid stands up and he goes, hey, during the Q&A, he goes, hey, look, this idea of corporate personhood, it's a bad idea because... And he ticked off a number of reasons. And Romney turned it back around, and Romney's getting better at answering this, which is pandering to pensioners, pandering to every working person, saying, well, you know, you've got one of those 401k thingies. You're part of the investor class. And the reality is you're really not. You're at the whim of the 1% who own probably 90% of the investable stock in this country. You're the last guy. You're the guy that gets screwed at the end of this. Your pension funds are the ones that get beat up during times of recession. Take a look at 2008. But since they've gotten us, and really they've done a masterful job of getting us in that mindset, that somehow, because I've got a 401k or I've got a pension fund, that I should be worrying about Wall Street. And I've got friends, you know, they've got mutual funds, they've got, you know, small investments because they're trying to squirrel a couple of bucks away for retirement, as you should do. And they're looking every day, checking their stocks, checking their mutual funds. They got us. I mean, it's amazing. Absolutely amazing stuff. But understand, Romney believes wholeheartedly
Corporations are people. And for me, that's a dividing issue. That's the issue where I think Obama has to take it to the streets. Quick break, right back after this. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Time to talk.
Of, for, and by, we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
This is WFTE 90.3 FM Mount Cobb and W289 AU 105.7 FM Scranton, Pennsylvania. Listen to us throughout Northeast Pennsylvania or check us out on the web at WFTE.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Some politicians are playing politics, pushing a so-called right-to-work law. This law is an attack on working people and does nothing to create jobs. We need our leaders to stop targeting workers and start working to fix our economy.
Indiana Republicans are trying to push through a so-called right-to-work law aimed at weakening workers' union rights. Indiana AFL-CIO spokesperson Jeff Harris says Republicans are locking Hoosiers out of their statehouse while they carry out their attack on working families.
As the legislature goes into session, we will try to have people enter the statehouse, and there will be thousands of people outside the statehouse trying to get in. It's designed literally by the 1% to attack the 99%. Right to work is about taking unions down. Organized labor is the last great voice standing in opposition to total corporate control, and that's what they're going after. It stood strong last year. We fought not only right to work, but onslaught of other anti-worker bills, and we are going to try to do our best again. But the tactics that we're seeing in Indiana, like we saw in Wisconsin, are just chilling.
The Indiana AFL-CIO says if this deceptively titled right-to-work legislation is passed, it will have a wide-ranging and overwhelmingly negative impact on workers' wages, safety conditions, and rights on the job. Cooper Tire workers in Findlay, Ohio, are on day 40 of being locked out of their production plant. Jesse Russell reports.
More than 1,000 workers are being denied work due to an inability to reach a new contract agreement. The last time the company sat down with the United Steelworkers Union, which represents the employees at the plant, was on December 13th. This weekend, Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown met with the employees to tell them he would do everything he can to get them back to work, and he called what Cooper was doing unfair.
Productivity of American workers continues to go up. Corporate profits continue to go up, yet wages are stagnant, and that's a shrinking middle class.
No new dates have been set for negotiations, but a federal mediator is scheduled to begin setting up discussions the week of January 11th.
During the Rose Bowl parade this week, a Wisconsin marching band stopped and broke into its rendition of the 1940 Woody Guthrie pro-labor song, Union Made. Commentators were clueless that the band was making a pro-union statement.
They just stopped in the middle of this band, and they're just getting down.
They just said, you want to get to this parade every so often, we're going to have some fun. Look at, they're doing their stuff. They think it's halftime.
It's a halftime performance. Are you kidding me?
This newscast made possible in part by Ulico, the Union Labor Life Insurance Company. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Demanding the super rich to pay their fair share for once. The Rick Smith Show. I got a
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Question, comment, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally. Today in labor history, this date back in 1933, angry farmers who've been foreclosed on in Iowa, and actual members of Iowa's Farmers Holiday Association, they marched into town threatening to lynch bank representatives and law enforcement officials who go after foreclosing on their farms. They did this through the duration of the Great Depression, and guess what? Stopped. I'm not saying people should be marching into town threatening to lynch people, but that's what happened today in labor history. It appears our president, as I said earlier, may have stolen Michelle Bachmann's titanium spine. It looks like there may be some recess appointments that have happened. That's why I've asked Travis Waldron, a reporter over at thinkprogress.org, to come talk to us a bit about Richard Cordry and the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Travis, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, nice being here. Thanks.
So has it happened? Have we seen the recess appointment of Cordry?
We have. He announced it today at a stop in Ohio, incidentally, the home of Richard Cordry, that he was going to appoint him. And then I don't know if you saw, but also that they were going to be there were going to be three recess appointments to the National Labor Relations Board, too, which was a little bit more shocking. I don't think people saw that one coming as much as the Cordry appointment.
Yeah, I was. You know, I've been calling for it from the beginning, and I said yesterday because I thought yesterday was the deadline that he had to recess appoint for the NLRB and other places, kind of like Teddy Roosevelt did, you know, over 100 years ago. Get your nominees in because it's apparent the Republicans aren't going to allow any of his nominees to be confirmed.
Exactly, and they went back. And looked at that precedent of Teddy Roosevelt, of Harry Truman, guys who had made these types of appointments, like the Roosevelt appointments came in less than a day's worth of recess. Truman made them after a little more than a day of recess. You know, Reagan's made these kind of appointments. It's not the most common form of recess appointment, but as my colleague Ian Millhiser pointed out yesterday, it's well within the president's powers to make this kind of call. So,
right, but
this,
at the end of the
conservative
day,
outrage is misplaced.
Right, but at the end of the day, if you've got a party that is so adamantly opposed to any progress, to any appointment whatsoever, no matter who you put up, they're going to deny and they're going to obstruct and block. At some point, you've got to go, they've got a scorched earth mentality. I've got to lead our government. I've got to get the job done. It's got to get done.
Right, and he alluded to that today in Ohio in his speech when he said he's not going to stand by while one party puts, you know, its own ideology above the best interests of the American people, and he's not going to sit there and watch them do that. And if they refuse to do their job, and the interesting thing is that many of these Republicans have said it's not about Richard Cordray, it's about their opposition to this agency as a whole, but this agency is a part of law.
Right.
So it gets a director by law, and if they are not going to do their job and appoint someone, then it falls to the president to make a recess appointment so that this agency can actually be effective.
Yeah, as I've seen written, they would object to any human being.
Exactly. It doesn't matter who it would be I think their line of attack is until there are substantial changes, weakenings, to this agency, they're just not going to move forward on it. And it finally has reached the point where I think the president said, you know, I'm going to do it whether you like it or not.
Yeah, I mean, on so many levels, I mean, I wish the president would take that stance because, you know, as I understand it, and probably you know a little bit better than I would, our court system is basically gridlocked now because we've got so many vacancies in the judicial branch. We've got so many vacancies in overseeing health, safety and health and food inspections because the Republicans are saying no. And, mm-hmm. and Obama has not, how many recess appointments? Like 28, 29?
I think, Cordry was his 29th. So if you add in, I think it was 29. So if you add in the three NLRB appointments, it would bring it to 32, which is still remarkably less than, for instance, the last three Republican presidents. Reagan averaged 30 recess appointments a year.
Yeah, if I remember right, it was
30 over 3 for Obama.
Yeah, I mean, if I remember right, the total number during the Reagan years was like almost 250.
It was 243, I believe, was the exact number for Reagan.
Yeah, so I don't remember people screaming too much about that, but here at the end of it, the rationale is, look, if you've got a party who's going to block any operation, the government has to operate. We've got to get things done. And if they're going to be the party of no, then you have to at some point say we're gonna do what legally is allowed and we're gonna recess appoint people.
Right, and that's his main logic behind the NLRB appointments as well. Is that if you look at the Supreme Court decision that threw out about 600 NLRB cases last year or in 2010, I'm sorry, it said it threw them out because the NLRB cannot have a two-person quorum. Right. So if there are only two members, it cannot make binding decisions. It was down to two members because Craig Becker, a member, his term had expired. The three appointments now bring it up to five, which actually protects them against the Republican member of the NLRB who had threatened to walk away to keep them from getting to quorum back in November. So now those protections are there so that the NLRB can operate, because we were going into this scenario where the NLRB was only going to have two members and could not legally make any decisions, which is what the Republicans want, frankly.
Oh, absolutely. And that's what they've been screaming for. They want to defund it. They want to cut it out of law. They want to neuter it. All the things that we've been talking about here on the program for the last several months. But I understand, and maybe you'll know better than I did, that one of the people he's going to recess appoint, this Terrence Flynn, is actually a Republican.
He is. He is the chief counsel to Brian Hayes, the Republican member of the board, the one who has incidentally threatened to quit, but he has been his chief counsel. He's been close to the board for quite a while now.
Did he have to do that?
I'm not positive whether he had to. I think it's generally, the NLRB is generally a fairly balanced.
It wasn't during the W years.
Right.
I guess the precedent there is it doesn't have to be, but I mean, if you want a fair and balanced board, I understand that you want to have some balance. And again, it goes back to, I think, his idea of how to govern. Because I got to be honest, he's a guy who's moved right to the middle, and this highlights it for me.
What, the Flynn nomination highlights it for you?
It does. I mean, on a lot of his decisions, he has gone, in my opinion, you could disagree, he has gone to the middle on a lot of decisions.
I mean, I think that could be considered a fair take on things, depending on the issue.
So let's go back, Travis, to this recess appointment of Richard Cordray. Why is this so important? I know on the left they really want this. This is so important. On the right, they think it's the end of the world. Is this Consumer Financial Protection Bureau going to be able to really rein in what's going on Wall Street? Because I got to be honest, I think it's out of control.
I think it will. I think the thing is without a director, the CFPB was very limited in what it could do. It couldn't actually prohibit the abusive, deceptive, the predatory practices that had taken place from all of these lenders, be they payday lenders, debt collectors, mortgage lenders, etc. It could not use its full authority without a director. It could do certain things, but could not exercise what it was intended to do fully. So now that Richard Cordray is there, I mean, it's going to be able to actually go to work on what we've seen, the foreclosure fraud, the discriminatory mortgage lending, practices that are predatory on payday loans, student loans, credit card lending, all these areas. It's actually going to be able to go to work on and try to, you know, lead the fight back for people and consumers who for a long time have not had a voice in that fight.
Because I think that's one of the first places that we should be focusing on, and he should have right from the beginning, was the foreclosure crisis. And I mm-hmm. advocated from the beginning a model based on the Home Ownership Loan Corporation, back during the Depression that Roosevelt set up, where the government set up a body to buy up these mortgages and to help people, you know, take the haircut, market value, and to help people stay in their homes and stabilize neighborhoods.
Right, and actually, incidentally, Richard Cordray was at the forefront of the foreclosure fraud investigations and lawsuits when he was the Attorney General in Ohio. He was the first Attorney General nationwide to sue one of the banks over its practices. He was investigating it. He was part of the widespread Attorney General investigation before he lost his bid for reelection. So, I mean, this is a guy who, I know there are a lot of progressives out there who want, you know, for them, this was Elizabeth Warren or bust. But this is a guy who is very qualified to be in this position. And it shows when you have an attorney who represents the financial institution telling people that Richard Cordray will be a very good director and that they fear him, that the industry, these institutions fear what he can do to bring some, you know, some advocacy for consumers, some oversight to this industry.
Well, it's about time. I got to tell you, it's about time.
I agree.
I mean, you know, they've gotten away with some shenanigans for far too long, and I'm hoping this guy hits the ground running. You know, last question I've got for you: what do you think of his first action is going to be? Do you have any sense of where he's going to direct his focus? Has any of that conversation happened?
I'm not. You know, I'm sure that behind the scenes they have. I would think that, you know, we have the attorney general's with their investigations into the foreclosure fraud. You have, you know, obviously you have Martha Coakley in Massachusetts who's investigating it on her own now. You have the overall investigation that involves some of the attorney generals, and then California and Nevada have their own investigation going on. I would think that that will likely be the place where it starts. There are plenty of places for it to start, but I think Obama has mentioned in past speeches that they want to look at the housing crisis. They want to really try to find solutions to get that going because that's a major drag on the economy right now. And I think trying to get some relief to homeowners and also homeowners who were defrauded and manipulated through the foreclosure process is one part of that. So I would not be surprised if that's the place where they start.
And I would love to see a line of perp walks into, I'd build a special wing on the San Quentin or some of the other places to put some of these criminals in, but that's a whole discussion for another day. Travis Waldron, a great talk with you. He's a reporter over at thinkprogress.org, does some fantastic work. I use your stuff quite often, Travis. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Alrighty, look forward to talking to you again. Let's take a quick break. Back with your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
The powers that be constantly try to pull the wool over people's eyes. But sometimes the wool blinders are so itchy that people rip them off and clearly see the scam. One of the itchiest ever is the Kafkaesque fiction put forth by America's right-wing power establishment that corporations are persons with the constitutional right to control our elections with their bottomless troves of corporate cash. This is an absurd perversion of nature itself. A person, after all, has a navel. Where's the corporate navel? Or its heart, brain, or soul? Also, if a corporation is a person, shouldn't it be subject to frontline military duty? To jail for its criminal violations and even to the death penalty? As a listener pointed out to me in a recent email, many states do not allow persons under 18 years of age to marry, or in corporate terminology, to merge. Plus, such young persons are subject to curfews and cannot legally be served alcohol. If you see a young corporation violating any of these teen laws, call the cops on them. When a corporate and governmental cabal makes such a power play that the very idea of it becomes a national joke, both the idea and the cabal are in trouble. That's the case with a comical claim of personhood for corporations. All across the country, beneath the radar of America's clueless elites, a savvy and scrappy grassroots coalition is mobilizing to overturn the anti-democratic effort by the Supreme Court, corporate front groups, and political sellouts to enthrone corporate money over the people. On January 20th and 21st, there will be two national days of action to rally public support for a constitutional amendment to reject the farce of corporate personhood. This is Jim Hightower saying, to join the rebellion, connect with www.movetoamend.org and www.democracyisforpeople.org.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Fuzzy math. It's fuzzy math. It's fuzzy math. I'm practicing fuzzy math. Well, I have been eating fudge the numbers and not tell the truth. For diplomacy to be effective, lies must be credible. The best way to win an election is deliberate deception. Same thing happened in 2000. George Bush lost. And I know that. So let me just tell you what the facts are.
I haven't heard that in a long time. Pulled that out of the archives, didn't you? 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com, or you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So Randy Johnson, he's one of more than 250 workers who worked at this American Pad and Paper Company in Marion, Indiana. He's one of the 250 people who lost their jobs thanks to Bain Capital. What those workers did, they had the audacity to say, you know what, we have a collective bargaining agreement, and we don't want massive pay cuts. We'd like to have a voice in our working conditions. We'd like to have some say. And Bain said, well, no, not going to happen. Not going to happen. We're going to kick you to the curb. And then they went and did what they do. They basically kicked them to the curb. Now, look, you know, I remember the 80s. And this is one of those times where you go, how many people remember the 80s? The corporate raiding that went on. The idea that you could gobble up a company like, you know, ABC Paper Company that's been in this area for 100 years, and it's been generational. Fathers and sons worked there. You know, they had a tidy little business, made a little profit, but had good-paying jobs for the locals with a pension and health care, and really was the anchor of the community. How many people remember how these big companies like Bain and others, like Romney's group and others, came around and said, you know what, we're gonna suck those up, take that overpayment into the pension fund, and that pension money, we're going to invest it somewhere else so we can do that to other people. And we can gobble up more and more. And we can cut people off to die. Which is basically what these big companies do. You know, they go in, they suck up the local business, they find what's the most profitable segment, and they let everything else die. Now, the rest of it created profit, not an acceptable profit. And I always go back to, how many people remember the department store Clover? When I first moved to Allentown, there was a Clover store there. And it was a nice little store. It kind of reminded me when I was a kid, the department stores that were in Cleveland that were almost all unionized before Walmart killed everybody else off. But they were closed because they weren't making, it's not that they weren't making a profit. They weren't making an acceptable profit. So it wasn't worth our time to run anymore because we're not making enough money. We're making money, but it's not enough. And I always found that to be kind of remarkable. That's the new business model. That we have to make double-digit profits, or we have to continue the double our profit margins every couple of years in order to, well, that's just what I want. And then they build up these communities and they tear them down. And it's turned into a hustle. It really has. It's turned into a con. It's something that would make the mafia blush. These big companies come in and say, well, we're gonna leave and your community is gonna be left with a huge hole in it. Because all those unemployed people who had disposable income are no longer gonna be able to go to those local shops. And they say, you're gonna have to give us millions of dollars or we're leaving. Because this other local community wants to make their community better by giving us millions of dollars so we bring these jobs there. I mean, it's really, and it's something I've said for the longest time, should be something the federal government should get involved in. Because it's a race to the bottom. And the Boeing situation, to me, was an important case. Because it was pitting states against one another. In that race to the bottom. And I look at, you know, you cross the Canadian border with Caterpillar, the guy we talked to yesterday. They want to cut those workers' pay by 55%. How many people today, how many could take a 55% pay cut? And I know, well, I would just go somewhere else. Well, good luck on that when everybody else is trying to do the exact same thing. Because that's what's going on here. I was reading something over at The Blaze. And one of their reporters are saying, you know, since the recovery, wages have gone down more. And you know why wages have gone down more during the recovery? Because you got more of these businesses going, hey, I see a chance to make more profit. More for me. And the heck with everybody else. I mean, Caterpillar had one of their most profitable years ever, according to the guy we talked to yesterday. And yet they wanted a 55% pay cut from every one of those workers so that it could have more.
The heck with the community. Don't care about the local business. Don't care about the local schools. Don't care about any of that. Care about profit for a few. And this is why I think we absolutely have to have someone minding the store. Because they've gotten away with this stuff for way too long. And it's like I talked about yesterday. You know, we keep hearing these grandiose ideas of liberty and justice and democracy. And I ask the question, how can you have those things? How can you have liberty, justice, or democracy when 90% of your nation is dependent on a handful of other people for their livelihoods, for their mere survival? How's that possible? Especially when you look at the fact that employers have absolutely no responsibility to the community. They have no responsibility to their employee. Nothing. Their responsibility, and this is a matter of law, a CEO's only responsibility is to their shareholders. That's it. What does that say about how we've structured business in this country? How we've allowed it to be narrowly focused to the direction of a handful. Whereas from before, you had to say, how's this business going to benefit society? And I think, you know, this whole push, and we're seeing it. We talked earlier with Erwin Aronson, our good friend, the attorney here, about this idea of the LLC contractor, where you're one guy, you're your own company, you're no longer a person, you're a corporation, you're a corporate person. But you're basically an employee because you have to do what they tell you to do, where they tell you to do it, how they tell you to do it. It's kind of interesting. And this whole idea of the ownership society that the Republicans keep throwing at us and a lot of Democrats keep throwing at us. You can own your own company. Yes, you yourself. You are a corporation. You can own your own health care. You're the man. You own your health care. Understand that when you get older, the price will continue to go up. And up until you can no longer afford it. And then what happens? Well, you die because you don't have access to health care. That's conservative world. You can own your own retirement. Oh, yes. Have 401k. And every couple of years, we'll have make sure that there's a bust that happens so your 401k turns into a 200.5 and half of your money is just evaporates so that you never can retire. Or my other favorite one, you can own your own college fund. Which basically means the federal government is going to walk away and the states are going to walk away from funding college education. But what they're really telling you with this whole idea of the ownership society is you're on your own. There's no we the people. There's me the individual. And there's you the individual. There's no more community. We're a nation of I's. And again, it goes back to that idea that are we astronauts or cowboys? You know, when you were a kid, which way did you go? Did you play cowboys and Indians or are you an astronaut? Did you have the mindset that I should be able to gallop and destroy anything I want, shoot the place up and consume and consume and consume and destroy and do what I want because I'm a rough, tough cowboy? Or do you have the mentality of an astronaut where, you know, we're in a confined space? We have to use our resources wisely. We have to think about others. We have to act in a community. I think that's very apparent in this election. The Republicans are all trying to be swaggering cowboys. At some point, rational thought has to at least pop into their heads. But maybe not. But we've moved toward and fast. I mean, Gingrich today, in front of a veteran, said he wants to voucherize veterans' health care. That's his word, voucherized. Not, I didn't make it up. They want to voucherize Medicare. They want vouchers for Medicaid. They want vouchers for education. They want vouchers for veterans now. They want the golden tickets. Oh, you got the voucher. Oh, the voucher's not going to pay for much. But you got it. You got the golden ticket. It looks shiny on the wall, doesn't it? Doesn't mount to a hill of beans, but you got it. Same thing they want to do with education here in this state. And to me, the vouchers are bad, in my view, but this educational improvement tax credit, much worse, much more dangerous.
But you've got people on both sides of the aisle going, well, it's a good idea. Instead of saying, you know what, corporations used to pay for the education that they benefit from. Now we're begging them for it? Doesn't make a lot of sense. I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Brian Buell, International Vice President with the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, Indiana, the right to work things back again. Quick break, back after this.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get The Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
Wednesday, January 4th, the Earth will be closest to the Sun for the year this evening, according to clocks in the U.S.
For the whole world, Earth's closest point to the Sun, called its perihelion, will come at 1 in the morning Universal Time on January 5th. Earth comes closest to the Sun every year in January during winter for the Northern Hemisphere. We're always farthest from the Sun in July during Northern Hemisphere summer.
So you can see it can't be Earth's distance from the Sun that causes the seasons. In fact, our planet has seasons because of its tilt on its axis. Earth's tilt causes the northern and southern hemispheres to trade places in receiving the Sun's light and warmth most directly as our world orbits the Sun.
Earth's closest and farthest points to the Sun don't cause the seasons, but they do affect the lengths of the seasons. When Earth is closest to the Sun for the year, as it is now, our world is moving fastest in orbit. The result is that Northern Hemisphere winters and Southern Hemisphere summers are the year's shortest seasons.
So that's our planet Earth closest to the Sun in 2012 on January 5th at hour number one, Universal Time. I'm Deborah Bird.
And I'm Jorge Salazar. Come to the Tonight area of EarthSky.org for sky charts. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
These are fighting the battles of the 1920s and the 1930s. And when we brought up things like the weekend or child labor laws, it's because things like right to work should be about as old a debate as they are.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at TheRickSmithShow.com. And you know, you would think after all this time that the failed policies of the radical right would be easily recognizable, yet there is this push like none other to destroy workers' rights, to destroy our ability to get to the ballot box. And in Indiana, one of the weirdest things I think I've seen in a long time, they want to ban our freedom of expression to sing our own national anthem. This idea that they're going to dictate how the national anthem should be sung, what melody, how the word, the enunciation, it's kind of insane. And mandate that all the schools that let people sing the national anthem, that they're going to have to keep records of that for 2 years. Absolutely insane. I think Indiana's losing its mind. But one of the more dangerous things they're doing, going after this, and I hate to call it right to work because there's no right to work. It's a right to work for a lot less money. There's no rights involved in this. But that's the phraseology that has been assigned to it. That's why I've asked Brian Buell, International Vice President with the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, to come talk to us about what's going on out there in Indiana. Brian, thanks for taking time for me.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
You know, I look at this, and again, you know, we've seen these attacks in Wisconsin. We've seen these attacks in places like Tennessee and pretty much in all of the states where Republican governors and Republican legislators have no one to control them.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. And it's no different here in Indiana. We have a supermajority of the Republicans in the Senate, a very strong majority in the House, and a Republican governor. And over the last year and a half, they've done nothing but attack working families here in Indiana.
Yeah, here in Pennsylvania, there are four pieces of legislation by Daryl Metcalf, or as I call him, Mad Cow, who, again, going after workers' rights, trying to make Pennsylvania a right-to-work-for-less state or a right-to-wreck state, however you want to put it. Because, you know, the states that have gone down this path, statistic after statistic shows lower standard of living, lower income, lower pension rates, lower health care rates. Why would any state want that?
Well, it's all a national agenda from the Right to Work Committee and the donors to the Republican Party. They want to silence the rights of the Hoosiers of the Democrat Party, and it's all about weakening unions' power at the bargaining table. It has nothing to do with protecting an individual's right to join or not join. It's all a coordinated effort to defeat the middle class and to bring power back to the Republican Party and the donors of the Republican Party.
So let me ask you, they love throwing it around, right to work. It sounds so great, doesn't it? I've got a right to work. Sounds wonderful. Are there any rights in the right to work?
Oh, absolutely not. And I think Martin Luther King hit it best some 40-some years ago when he said it provides no rights and it provides no work. You know, it's a cute slogan, but it has nothing to do with securing jobs in this state. The legislators here have been able to produce no concrete evidence that companies are turning away from Indiana because it's a non-right-to-work state, and it's all a political game being played by the Republicans to silence the base of the Democrat Party.
So they're using that argument there in Indiana as well, because they've been doing that here. They've been saying, well, you know, there are a lot of companies that the very first thing they look at is if it's a right, they say, tell me, you're right to work state? And then they just pass us over. They're using the same thing in Indiana?
Using the same thing in Indiana, yet when we call them on it, give us one company that's refused to come to Indiana because of a non-right to work state, and they provide no evidence of nothing. They get up there and throw some studies and some statistics around and have no evidence to back up any of it.
No, because there really isn't any. So let me ask you, what's the plan of attack? Because in Indiana, like here in Pennsylvania and a lot of other states, the Republicans have steamroller power.
Yeah, going back from January of last year, the only way we were able to kill the bill last year is that in Indiana you need 67 legislators present in order to have a quorum to conduct business. And for 5 weeks, our Democrats, 40 proud Democrats, fled the state and went to Illinois and held up in a hotel until right to work was taken off the table. So that's our only real avenue we have to pursue, is to get the Democrats to walk out of the state like they did back in January.
You think that's going to happen?
Well, I'm hopeful it will. The session started today, and the Democrats refused to enter the chamber when the session was convened at 1:30. And I came back here to catch this call, but I understand they had a press conference right after I left the State House in which the Democrats said they weren't coming back.
In Indiana,
that's our only hope right now.
In Indiana, is there any, because I know there was talk of passing some kind of legislation, and I forget what state it was, but it's saying that if you know, legislators left as they did in Wisconsin, as they did in Indiana, that they would be, you know, held criminally liable or fined or, you know, arrested or whatever. Is there any legislation like that?
Yes, what they did here, when they left the first time, there were fines on the books for not, performing your duties, and they were $250 a day. Well, with the Democrats not here, they made a rulemaking change, and they upped those fines to $1,000 a day, including loss of their income for performing their work. So, yeah, there's strong penalties to pay. You know, they quadrupled the fines here on the legislators for fleeing the state in an effort to try to keep them here this time.
Wow, how convenient.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of those legislators, you know, they suffered personally because of it. And I don't understand it, because the Constitution here in Indiana gives them a right that if they don't have a quorum, they can't conduct business. So really all they're doing, it's the Senate's version of the filibuster is really what they're doing here in the House in Indiana.
Yeah, I mean, is it possible to take that in, and I know this is a dumb question because it is another one of these Republican states with a Republican judiciary, but is it possible to take that into court and argue it?
There's legislation right now. There were some lawsuits filed over the fines that they levied on the Democrats for their five-week walkout last time. But it's my understanding that those cases haven't been adjudicated yet. So they're in the system, but they've just not been ruled on yet.
Let me ask you this, Brian. You know, and I looked at the, you know, this, something came across my desk that in Indiana they have a, and maybe it's not true, but they have a law that they're only allowed to have so many people in the state house.
Well, yeah, that was Governor Daniels' response to the protest that we were getting ready to engage in starting today. He knew what we went through last year, so he attempted to limit access to the state house to 3,000 people, of which 1,700 of them are employees. And also, he put in all kinds of other rules about making noise and what you could carry in, 2-foot signs and all that. But we had about 3,000 or 4,000 people there today, and at noon, the governor rescinded those rules. So he was taking a lot of pressure politically for imposing those rules to begin with, trying to silence the opposition. So, but he saw the way on that. He at least backed up and rescinded those rules as of today.
Yeah, I find it interesting that the people who claim that, you know, they're for the Constitution and they're for democracy and, you know, the people's voices do things like that, do things like in Wisconsin where they're, I guess you got to get a permit 72 hours in advance, it has to be approved. And
right.
you've got to pay, I think it's like $50 an hour per policeman. It's a whole bunch of stuff for a citizen
right.
to go what you're constitutionally allowed to do, go to your government for redress of grievances, but I guess they want to charge you for that.
Right, and he was going to limit access to ordinary citizens, but it was free rein on lobbyists coming into the state house, and they could use a special entrance where they didn't have to walk in the entrance that all the protesters were going to walk through.
Amazing stuff. Let me ask you, how's the polling out there on this right to work for less legislation? Because I've got to imagine that, you know, at some point, people wake up to the fact that the states that have gone to this, the states that have passed this, are doing much worse off in this recession than states that don't have it.
The most recent poll I've seen was a poll conducted by Ball State University, which was one of the state universities here in Indiana, and it showed 67% of Indiana residents against right to work. I think a lot of it is kind of what you said. It's a catchy catchphrase. And when you just ask somebody, do you support right to work, they may answer wrongly until you define what right to work is and really what implications they have, and then they flip-flop and they come back against right to work once they realize what the bill is really about.
Yeah, I mean, for me, at some point, don't we have to, because I remember, maybe you remember too, November of 2010, the Republicans swept into power and on the national level and in different states with claiming a laser-like focus on jobs, jobs, jobs. And I guess the question is how does right to work or voter suppression bills or any other insanity that they've pursued create any jobs?
It doesn't. It doesn't. And you're right. We do need jobs here in Indiana, not political tax on working families. And that's all we're getting out of this Republican administration and this Republican-controlled Congress here in Indiana.
Last question I got for you. What can I do to help? What can our listeners do to help? What do we do?
Well, we're flooding the state house with bodies every day to try to give some political cover to the Democrats who are proudly walking out to stop this bill. So, you know, anybody can help by sending bodies, making phone calls. We're reaching out. We're running a shuttle operation from our union hall down to the state house every day, picking people up from work, taking them down there, just doing everything we can, writing our senators and congressmen and emailing them and just trying to put as much pressure on them as we can.
Yeah, road trip. Sounds like a road trip to me.
Sounds good. We'd love to have you.
All right, Brian, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much. Keep up the fight, brother.
Thank you very much, Rick.
Thanks so much. Brian Baiuli, International Vice President with the Teamsters Union. You know, look, if we can stop it in Indiana, it's going to stop here. And if you look at the leaked memo from the Corbett administration, even they recognize if you stop it in other states, they're not going to pursue it here. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around.
And we're not going to break tonight, and we're not going to bend. Some say the union's down, but I asked around, and everybody's saying this is a union time.
bargain. Divided we beg.
On July 5, 1935, the National Labor Relations Act was signed into law. It is also known as the Wagner Act after its chief sponsor, New York Senator Robert Wagner. Prior to its passage, Senator Wagner chaired the National Labor Board, created by Franklin Roosevelt in 1933 to attempt to bring order to labor-management relations. The National Labor Board consisted of three representatives from labor and three from industry, with Wagner as the chairman. It was here that Senator Wagner realized government assistance was required to level the playing field if labor unions were to effectively bargain with management. President Roosevelt said of the National Labor Relations Act, "It should serve as an important step toward the achievement of just and peaceful labor relations in industry." Hailed as the Magna Carta of labor, once the National Labor Relations Act was signed into law, workers were encouraged and protected to exercise their newly recognized rights to freedom of association, self-organization, and engage in concerted activities for the purpose of collectively bargaining through a representative of their own choosing in order to establish wages, hours, and conditions. Employer interference, such as threats and intimidation, firing, refusing to negotiate with the union, and discrimination for union activity were expressly prohibited. These illegal activities are described as unfair labor practices by the law. The impact of the Wagner Act on American life was substantial. The standard of living for American workers, their families, and communities was extraordinary. Unionization rates increased to a high of 35% of the American workforce as American workers demanded their rights. Working men and women finally had a unified voice to stand up and fight for dignity, respect, and safety in their workplace. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Absence works. Maybe it's the way it's being taught or the way that it's being applied out there. But the fact of the matter is, it is the best form of to teach our children.
I want to be a cowboy, and you can be my cowgirl. I want to be a cowboy, and you can be my cowgirl.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. I know he has gone home to reassess. Rick Perry's gone home to reassess his campaign, but I really hope he doesn't go away, because now that Bachman's out of it, there's less comedy relief. I mean, now that the cheesy dwarf left, Snow White's out, Dopey. I don't want Dopey to go. I like Dopey, especially when he does that kind of I'm all drugged up kind of goofy speech thing he does. I'm really gonna miss that. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Thoughts, comments, questions, something on your mind. And going back to Tom Corbett for a minute, and looking at what's going on around the country, all of these Republican governors and the Republican legislators that have gone after this really toxic national agenda. You go after suppressing voters' rights, go after women's rights, go after workers' rights, this whole national plan. Corbett saying, look, in the secret memo, and you got to love this, his own administration leaks the grand secret memo where he actually goes after each one of these governors. He goes after Walker, he goes after Kasich in Ohio, he goes after Snyder in Michigan, Nikki Haley, Rick Scott, he goes after even Paul LePage up in Maine. And he's going, hey, how do I compare against those insaniacs? And it's pretty amazing that even he admits that, Walker in Wisconsin, for instance, pushed through the bill stripping unions of collective bargaining rights. We didn't do that. We didn't do anything stupid like that. And thank God he didn't. Because the reality is, I think he would have been met with the same kind of fervor that happened here. He said that, Walker faced tens of thousands of protesters camping out in the state capitol. Oh boy, glad we didn't get that. There are people camped out on the steps of the Capitol right now, if you need to know. But just not tens of thousands yet. He said special interest forced recall elections. Well, you know what? We don't have recall elections, so I don't really know that that's a talking point. Generally, talking points are supposed to be things you've done well. You want to talk well of yourself? All he's doing is ripping on his fellow Republicans, which I find hysterical. He talks about Snyder, and, look, The corporate administration, I can give them credit for one thing. They have stayed out of controversy. The problem is they haven't done anything. And my problem with not doing anything is they haven't helped get us out of this mess. I mean, I'm happy that none of the really toxic stuff happened. I'm happy that the attack on workers' rights with Mad Cow's four bills, 50 through 53, I'm happy those went nowhere. The unemployment comp bill, I'm happy, wasn't as toxic as originally was going to be. The workers' comp bill that's going to make it to where injured workers, 95% of injured workers never see their own doctor. I'm glad that's gone nowhere. The voucher thing, all of that, I'm glad went nowhere. Because they're bad ideas. It's bad policy. It's bad government. But in the process of doing nothing, of doing all of this stuff that amounted to nothing, what they've done is they've squandered an entire year where they had an opportunity to get us out of a recession, to get us employed, to create jobs, to create an environment where you could have job creation. That's my problem. There was an opportunity to help working families, and they've lost it. Look, these ideologues that are running our state government, they're dangerous because they are strictly ideologues, and they're ideologues who don't believe in government. These are people who want to sell off anything that is yours and mine. Anything that belongs to we the people, they want to hock off to what now would be the low bidder. Look, I understand. There's a point at which rational thought has to come into things. And if someone said to me, Rick, we could easily get $3 billion for the wine and spirit shops. You're still going to get the taxes out of it, but you're going to get upfront $3 billion. You may want to have a conversation about it. Now, understand, we get $500 million every year from the profits, from the taxes, from the operation of it. Could it be operated a little bit better? Sure. And they're always working to improve, and I'm quite happy with how they have done. But you're talking about $500 million a year coming into the coffers. Even at $3 billion, that's only 6 years of what you were getting. So in the seventh year, what do you get? Well, nothing. So you've lost that asset. And I go back to this idea that the right has perpetrated. This idea that nothing that is ours, nothing that is we of the peoples, is run right. This idea that private for-profit corporations always do the right thing is nonsense. They do the right thing for themselves. I'll agree with that. At that moment, their self-interest, they're doing the right thing for them. But for society, for all of us, I'm not buying it. And I think in the what happens in the next 20, 30 years, what's going to have to happen is townships and cities and states are going to have to own things. You're going to have to own your transportation. You're going to have to own certain things, stadiums, for instance. If we're building them, we're using tax dollars to build them, we should benefit from them. Don't you think? I mean, just on some level, healthcare. You know, we used to provide ourselves health care. We said as a community, we're going to make sure that we've got a place when we get sick or we get injured, that we go and we get care. Community hospitals. I was born in Deaconess Community Hospital. It's now gone. It's now part of the big conglomerate for profit. But we used to think that way. Now it's all, how can we make the most profit, even in health care? Which, as I've said in the past, healthcare is one of those things that, I'm sorry, I just don't ever think should be run as a for-profit entity. I don't think you should have something where my demise, where if I get cancer or if I have a heart attack, that's looked on as additional revenue. Oh, boy, we filled a bed with a sick person. Because if you're doing that and you're thinking of the mindset, how do we put bodies in the beds and how do we use our MRIs and how do we use all of this equipment more and more and more to generate more revenue and more profit, and how do we squeeze wages and how do we do all these things to benefit a handful, then we're not thinking of, you know, how do we clean up the toxic dump so people don't get cancer? We're not thinking of, hey, what do we do with all the sugary this or that or these additives or these drugs? Or we're not thinking that way anymore. We're thinking, how can we profit? How can we put more money in our pocket? That's what's happened with the privatization of everything into the hands of a few. And I know, there's somebody out there, hey, you're talking socialism. On a small scale, yeah, absolutely. I believe in we the people. I believe in us. I have this weird belief that we're capable. And I saw it when we went to Wisconsin. All those kids who hold up in the Capitol and said, you know what, we're not leaving until we have our demands met, until we have our voices heard. They set up a community. They set up a place for people to get food. They set up a place for people to get health care if they needed it. They set up child care. They set up all of these things that a society needs because that's how we're built. We're structured. It's in our DNA that we take care of one another. This idea that the Republicans are ramming down our throats and the right-wing conservative media is just drum-beating that hooray for me and the heck with everybody else is nonsense and it's dangerous and it's going to destroy this nation. And there's part of me that thinks that's what they want. Because that's when they can really profit. That's when they can really make big bucks. And that's a scary thought. It really is a scary thought when you hear some of these people talk about their vision on how they would deal with, for instance, how they would deal with the foreclosure crisis. Romney, you know, a guy who said, well, you know, it'd be a harder down. Or that was Toomey. Romney said this.
As to what to do for the housing industry specifically, and are there things that you could do to encourage housing? One is don't try and stop the foreclosure process. Let it run its course and hit the bottom, allow investors to buy homes, put renters in them, fix the homes up, and let it turn around and come back up. The Obama administration has slow walked the foreclosure processes that have long existed, and as a result, we still have a foreclosure overhang.
So his idea, simple, was let it bottom up. And then once all of you working people, once you lose your dream, once you lose that American dream to own a home that we put in front of you, you got a smell of it, and then we yanked it away, then the vultures come in. Then the capitalists come in, and because they've been doing well all these years, and they buy those up, and they rent you back the house that at one point you were trying to own. And we got people in this country go, well, you know, they were irresponsible. No. They lost their jobs. They work for a company like Caterpillar up in Canada who said, well, you know what? Today, you're working for 55% less. And I go back to what the guy at the Blaze wrote. You know, the wages have gone down even more since the recession. That's Obama's fault. To a part it is. Because he hasn't really done what I told him he should have done from the beginning, which is to make sure that workers have rights and have the right to collective bargaining, the right to join and form unions. That stops that free fall. And, yeah, you're going to have some battles, and I'm all in favor of you're going to have to take this stuff to the streets. But if you have no voice, it just happens. You look at those workers in Canada. They're fighting back. Without a union, it just happened. Quick break right back after this.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
This is WFTE 90.3 FM Mount Cobb and W289 AU 105.7 FM Scranton, Pennsylvania. Listen to us throughout Northeast Pennsylvania or check us out on the web at WFTE.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Some politicians are playing politics, pushing a so-called right-to-work law. This law is an attack on working people and does nothing to create jobs. We need our leaders to stop targeting workers and start working to fix our economy.
Indiana Republicans are trying to push through a so-called right-to-work law aimed at weakening workers' union rights. Indiana AFL-CIO spokesperson Jeff Harris says Republicans are locking Hoosiers out of their statehouse while they carry out their attack on working families.
As the legislature goes into session, we will try to have people enter the statehouse, and there will be thousands of people outside the statehouse trying to get in. It's designed literally by the 1% to attack the 99%. Right to work is about taking unions down. Organized labor is the last great voice standing in opposition to total corporate control, and that's what they're going after. It stood strong last year. We fought not only right to work, but onslaught of other anti-worker bills, and we are going to try to do our best again. But the tactics that we're seeing in Indiana, like we saw in Wisconsin, are just chilling.
The Indiana AFL-CIO says if this deceptively titled right-to-work legislation is passed, it will have a wide-ranging and overwhelmingly negative impact on workers' wages, safety conditions, and rights on the job. Cooper Tire workers in Findlay, Ohio, are on day 40 of being locked out of their production plant. Jesse Russell reports.
More than 1,000 workers are being denied work due to an inability to reach a new contract agreement. The last time the company sat down with the United Steelworkers Union, which represents the employees at the plant, was on December 13th. This weekend, Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown met with the employees to tell them he would do everything he can to get them back to work, and he called what Cooper was doing unfair.
Productivity of American workers continues to go up. Corporate profits continue to go up, yet wages are stagnant, and that's a shrinking middle class.
No new dates have been set for negotiations, but a federal mediator is scheduled to begin setting up discussions the week of January 11th.
During the Rose Bowl parade this week, a Wisconsin marching band stopped and broke into its rendition of the 1940 Woody Guthrie pro-labor song, Union Made. Commentators were clueless that the band was making a pro-union statement.
They just stopped in the middle of this band, and they're just getting down.
They just said, you want to get to this parade every so often, we're going to have some fun. Look at, they're doing their stuff. They think it's halftime.
This is a halftime performance. Are you kidding me?
This newscast made possible in part by Ulico, the Union Labor Life Insurance Company. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome to the new dark ages.
You know, if Rick Santorum has his way and Gingrich and the rest of the radical right, if they have their way, we will be, if you're a woman, we're going back to the dark ages. Tricky Ricky recently said that, a state should have the right to outlaw birth control. No, it's no longer about abortion. And look, I've been telling you this for years. It's not about Roe versus Wade. It's about Griswold. It's about taking that right away and making women, subservient. And there's part of me, and I'll be honest, being that I have the right chromosomes, there's part of me that says, I might be okay with that. Might be okay if women were subservient to me, the master. But the problem is I got two daughters, and I don't know that I want them to live in that world. And that is my main problem with people like Santorum and Gingrich and the rest of the radical right, that they want to take these rights away from my daughters, and I got to be honest, can't have it. That's why I've asked Jacqueline Friedman, the editor of the hit anthology Yes Means Yes. She also has a new workbook out, What You Really, Really Want. You can find that at whatyoureallyreallywant.net or at the link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Jacqueline Friedman's name. Jacqueline, thanks for taking time for me.
Happy to be here.
So, I'm looking at Tricky Ricky and I'm looking at Newt Gingrich and I'm going, it's amazing how easy it rolls off their tongue. That they seem to think that you're a second-class citizen and you shouldn't have the right to whatever you want to do with your own body.
Well, it's hardly an original observation, but it can't be said often enough. These are the men who are out front saying that government should be small enough to drown in the bathtub, except when it comes to my uterus. Right, when it comes to our bedrooms, and especially if you have one, your uterus, they want the most intrusive government possible. And it's just, it's the ultimate hypocrisy, and it makes obvious what their agenda is, right? It's not about small government for them. It's about a government that serves their interests, and obviously their interests are in opposition to mine.
Right. And, you know, and I look at this and I go, you know, why would there be any woman who would vote for any of those yet? Yet there are a number, especially for Santorum with this whole evangelical myth, this whole aura he puts around himself that he's this big Christian, when I got to tell you, I think anything but.
Well, it's certainly not in a sense that Christ would have approved of him. the Christian church or some branches of it may. It is a little bit mysterious to me as to why women vote for him as well. We know that about 99% of American women use birth control. It's marvelous on one level that he's come out and finally said what we've known for a long time is underneath the anti-abortion agenda, which is not just about controlling access to abortion, it's controlling women's access to our own sexuality, plain and simple. And we've known that sort of in a subterranean way for a long time. Like you said, you've been saying that for a long time, and so have I. But in some ways, it was a relief for him to come out and just say, you know, birth control should be outlawed because it allows us to, you know, make sex just about pleasure. I'm barely paraphrasing there, which is a bad thing in Rick Santorum's book. So it's great he's being honest, but the problem I see, aside from the terrifying idea that someone, him or someone who shares his ideas may get into power, is also that it creates room for, say, President Obama to shift to the right also. I mean, we saw that on the recent Plan B ruling. You know, the FDA said Plan B should be legal to be over-the-counter, period, full stop. There's no risk of it. And he said, well, because I have two daughters, I think it's really interesting that you use that argument when you were just talking about it. Because I have two daughters, I'm going to be the pater familias for the entire country and say, if you're under 17, you can't get access.
And again, you know, you go back to that father argument. I want my daughters to be safe. And it's like on the abortion argument. I'm not for abortion. I'm actually kind of against it, but I am pro safety. You know, and it's a number of these things. I want my daughters to be able to protect themselves. I want to make sure that they have the ability, to not get pregnant if they so choose to have sex, which is why I think Plan B should be accessible. But you know, you look at, and it should be mandatory. If you're running a pharmacy, it should have to be there. You shouldn't be one of those choice things, in my opinion.
And it should be over the counter. I mean, if you think about a 15-year-old girl, what it's going to take for her to go ask the pharmacist for it or go to a doctor and get a prescription, and Plan B is the sort of thing where you need to take it immediately, it really makes it a terrible situation for the most vulnerable girls who might be in this situation. And the idea that it's dangerous is preposterous. There are many more dangerous pills sold over the counter. I mean, a bottle of Advil is more dangerous than Plan B. There are only a couple of pills in the pack. There's not much damage you can do.
Right.
So it is this sort of idea that, you know, father knows best, and I admire your approach to your daughters, which is, you know, that you want to raise them with choices and with choices that will keep them safe, right? And not that you get to control their bodies for the rest of their lives.
Now, I do have a cyanide pill and a necklace around my neck for if I ever find out about this stuff. That's a whole other argument for
well,
another
that's
day.
That's your business.
but, you know, look, at the end of it, you know, I go back to my mother, who, you know, years ago when I was a kid, the whole Roe versus Wade thing was in the courts, and it was new, and she had told me a story of someone that went to Kentucky actually to go get a backroom abortion, and she ended up dying from an infection, and that has stuck with me all these years, and which is why I'm of the mindset of pro safety.
Exactly. It's perfectly fine. You know, you're free to be against abortion if you recommend that your daughters don't get one, but the idea that your opinion should make it illegal for me really is what doesn't hold water.
It's kind of un-American if you think about it.
It's absolutely un-American, and it is the biggest government, big government policy ever. You know, but it also, again, it's beyond abortion. We know that actually it's not just Rick Santorum. He's coming out and saying it very frankly, but all the candidates except Romney have signed that Personhood USA pledge,
right,
which, you know, defines personhood as starting at fertilization of a sperm and egg, like before implantation. I probably meet a person last night. And what that bill would do, all joking aside, that pledge would do is it would make the IUD illegal. It would make some forms of the pill illegal, right? All the candidates except Romney have signed the pledge saying they're against birth control also.
Well, and when I was reading through that, my first thought was eventually this is going, if they pass this and this happens, eventually it's going to be no longer conception. It's going to be when the conditions are, one of the conditions are there. So ovulation will be against the law, and so will what 13-year-old boys do in their room quietly.
Every sperm is sacred, yes.
And that may be the battle cry. But here's the thing, and you look at somebody like Gingrich, who says that he would make no exceptions for rape and incest. And I said, well, A, is it your body? And B, what are you going to do with all of these children then? Are you going to take care of them? Are you going to fund programs so they get education, they get health care? Are you going to do that? And the answer is generally no. These are pro-birth people, not pro-family or pro-child people.
Gingrich is going to, put them to work cleaning their classmates' toilets once he revokes the child labor laws, as he wants to do. He's absolutely not pro-child or pro-family. He's pro-birth. And the idea that any candidate, and again, we're seeing, Santorum absolutely, Gingrich absolutely, saying that they would force a woman who has had her body violated in the most unimaginable way possible to force her to take further control away from her body and force her to carry a child for 9 months against her will. It's forced pregnancy and forced birth is torture. I think that's a human rights violation. It's beyond un-American. It's just unconscionable. Who is he to decide that?
What I find interesting, you bring up the fact that he wants cheap labor. That's not a new concept. I think of Tom DeLay, the Hammer, who was the Speaker of the House. He said this once.
If we had those 40 million children that were killed over the last 30 years, we wouldn't need the illegal immigrants to fill the jobs that they are doing today.
That's his idea.
Yes, I have heard that, right? God forbid we should employ brown people. Instead, we should force that. I mean, I don't know who he thinks those women were who were. It's so complicated,
It's insane is what it is.
To produce labor. It's slavery, really.
I mean, it's amazing to me that you have these people who women actually vote for. And I got to ask you, what's wrong with them? I mean, I look at Romney, who he was rational at one point, said, he was pro-choice. I'm never going to have an abortion. You do what you got to do. Now he's really taking a very hard stance.
Well, I think they rule by fear. I mean, the reality is that not just the majority of women, but the majority of Americans are on the side. More than 80% of Americans believe in the rape and incest exception, and nearly 90% of them believe in an exception for the life of the mother. So this is not a controversial view. But I think what's happening, you see the Republicans, and this is what they've done for years, is they rule by fear. And so they're pandering to their base, to the extreme right of their base right now, and they're counting on the fact that they've got enough constituents who are afraid about the economic situation, who believe in their divide and conquer politics on the economy and want to be on the side of the people who are winning, and are afraid of the terrorists and want them to protect them from the terrorists. They've sown enough fear that people are willing to put aside this idea because most people don't need an abortion right now. Well, I really think the reality is they're thinking, right now, in this moment in my life, most people are thinking, I'm more at risk of losing my job or I don't have a job already than I am at needing an abortion or someone I love needing an abortion right now. So that's what I'm going to prioritize. It's a really short-sighted politics of fear, and they're playing right into it.
Yeah, but at the end of the day, the reality being what it is, we've got enough people on the planet. We've got enough people living in poverty, and yet we want to force more people to have children because we're not even being rational. I mean, look, I can sympathize. I can say, okay, I understand you don't want to have the abortion, but plan B, isn't that a good compromise? You're stopping it before it happens. Maybe birth control, a little education, stop it before it happens. Isn't that sane, rational?
If you actually think abortion is a crime or a moral violation, you ought to be, one ought to be, I don't mean you personally, one ought to be pro-birth control and pro-plan B, right? That the idea would be to make abortion less necessary. By becoming transparent about their agenda, by finding this person USA portion of his USA Pledge and by Santorum's comments, they're saying, like, no, this isn't really about a practical concern about abortion. This is about our agenda to control women's bodies, pure and simple.
If we criminalize it, will it stop?
If we criminalize abortion, of course not. It didn't stop before it was when it was criminalized. It'll just put women greater at risk. It'll actually put poor women and women of color at an even greater risk, right, because they'll have less access to the money it will cost to get an underground abortion. And you know, a lot of women will die. A lot of unwanted children will be born into families that can't afford to support them or families that don't want them, which isn't going to be a healthy family for them to grow up in. No, it's going to create a much less just America than the one we're living in.
But the daughters,
it's not going to stop abortion.
But the daughters of the Romneys and the wealth class, they I'm sure they'll have their doctors who are
willing. Well, that's the thing. They'll always be able to get one, so they don't have to worry about it.
Well, at least we're taking care of them. And that's
yes,
what's important.
Exactly.
That is what's important. Again, the book is, the workbook is What You Really, Really Want. The website, whatyoureallyreallywant.net. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Jacqueline Friedman's name. Always great to talk with you. And, you know, it's not one of my favorite topics.
No,
But you're very well informed and articulate on the topic. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. Thoughts, questions, comments. What's on your mind? We're right back.
Smith Show.
The powers that be constantly try to pull the wool over people's eyes. But sometimes the wool blinders are so itchy that people rip them off and clearly see the scam. One of the itchiest ever is the Kafkaesque fiction put forth by America's right-wing power establishment that corporations are persons with the constitutional right to control our elections with their bottomless troves of corporate cash. This is an absurd perversion of nature itself. A person, after all, has a navel. Where's the corporate navel? Or its heart, brain, or soul? Also, if a corporation is a person, shouldn't it be subject to frontline military duty? To jail for its criminal violations and even to the death penalty? As a listener pointed out to me in a recent email, many states do not allow persons under 18 years of age to marry, or in corporate terminology, to merge. Plus, such young persons are subject to curfews and cannot legally be served alcohol. If you see a young corporation violating any of these teen laws, call the cops on them. When a corporate and governmental cabal makes such a power play that the very idea of it becomes a national joke, both the idea and the cabal are in trouble. That's the case with a comical claim of personhood for corporations. All across the country, beneath the radar of America's clueless elites, a savvy and scrappy grassroots coalition is mobilizing to overturn the anti-democratic effort by the Supreme Court, corporate front groups, and political sellouts to enthrone corporate money over the people. On January 20th and 21st, there will be two national days of action to rally public support for a constitutional amendment to reject the farce of corporate personhood. This is Jim Hightower saying, to join the rebellion, connect with www.movetoamend.org and www.democracyisforpeople.org.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Smith Show. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. You know, I got to be honest, it's one of my least favorite topics to talk about. You know, and that's, I think, the reason Republicans talk about it so often. Because they know, look, it's uncomfortable to talk about abortion. It's uncomfortable sometimes to talk about gay rights. But at the end of the day, I don't want to get into a situation where my daughters, they're second-class citizens. I don't want to get into a situation where if I have a relative or a friend who's gay is a second-class citizen. Understand, the Constitution has equal protection for all. Understand, that means something, equal protection for everybody. But our friends on the right, they only think protection belongs to those who can afford it, those who have the money to hire the lawyers, those who have the money to hire the lobbyists, those who have the money to buy campaigns. And I was reading this article over at the Reading Eagle. It's one of those things, you know, in talking about my daughters, that I'm hoping at some point it closes. The article was titled Narrowing the Pay Gap. And it's talking about the Bureau of Labor Statistics came out with some numbers. The census came out with some numbers and said, look, on a national level, women are paid about 78 cents for every dollar that a man's paid. Here in Pennsylvania, it's actually worse. It's like 66 cents for every dollar. And in Berks County, where the Reading Eagle is, it's 64 cents for every dollar that a man makes. And what I found interesting is, again, a very conservative newspaper, one would argue a kind of a right-wing newspaper, who presents these statistics in a way where you go, well, it must not be bad, because the banker, the investment banker that they chose to go to, the woman who's an investment banker, she says, well, I make just as much as my male counterparts because it's based on performance. It's a meritocracy. And then I start to think about the CEOs of Bank of America, the CEOs of Goldman Sachs, the CEOs of Wells Fargo, all of these very well-to-do CEOs who, you know, keep talking about, you know, the grand meritocracy and how wonderful, you know, it is and how we're holding bankers accountable. Now, understand, Bank of America, their stock dropped 60%. Their market value dropped 60%. Yet their CEO took almost $2.3 million last year. Jamie Dimon, the CEO of Chase, took $42 million. Their stock lost about 23%. Lloyd Blankenfein, Goldman Sachs, nearly $22 million. His stock tanked 46%. Meritocracy? So they go to this investment banker, this woman who, well, it's a meritocracy. In the finance world, she says it's a meritocracy, and I've just told you where it's not. But according to her, in her worldview and her beliefs, now she makes just as much as the man. But understand, a lot of these places, and I go back to where my wife used to, where she was a manager of a billing company. If her employees told each other how much they make, they both got fired. You signed on the dotted line that was okay. So she doesn't, I don't think this woman really knows, but it's a good talking point, which is why they went to her, which is why you go to a banker to say, well, you know, it's not such a problem. And she even gave a presentation to the Chamber of Commerce. But the numbers don't lie. The numbers are pretty clear. Today, the average salary of an American woman is about $36,500. The average salary of a man is $46,500. Those are census numbers. They don't lie. It's what it is. Pennsylvania, a woman makes about a little over $26,000. A man makes close to $40,000. Those are the numbers. Is what it is. There in Berks County, a woman makes almost $28,500 or $25,800. A man makes almost $40,000. Them's the numbers, folks. No lying there. Education makes up a little bit of the difference, but not as much as you might think. A bachelor's degree got you to almost 70 cents on a dollar. So a little bit better, but not the leaps and bounds that people are going to tell you. Then they decide that they're going to a temporary service to ask, do you pay your women and your men equally? And, of course, the temp service is going to go, yeah, we screw them all equally. We cheat them all equally. They make virtually nothing equally. See, we're equal opportunity thieves. And I'm just shaking my head going, you know, I'm amazed. And you go down to the comment section, and what are they talking about? This is gender war. Really? pointing out facts, pointing out what has been the case since the beginning of the country. Women have been second-class citizens. That's gender war? Is that how you see that? The fact that you actually have an Equal Pay Act passed back in 1963 to begin to close the gap kind of makes you wonder. Gender war! It's the same thing they do when workers say, you know what? We'd like a share of the pie. We'd like a bit of the wealth that we create, please. And then when they start demanding, then that's class war. It's not class war when the Caterpillar company up there in Ontario says you have to take a 55% pay cut, even though we're more profitable than we've ever been. That's not class war. That's just good, sound business. Class war is when you people at the bottom start asking for more. Understand that. Class war is when you know the people who have been beat up and demoralized, the Stockholm syndrome that I've talked about. Because it's amazing to me, absolutely amazing to me, that we as a working class haven't risen up and said enough is enough. This recession is BS. You need to fix it. Somehow we haven't figured that out yet. And every time we see a company go, oh, you know what? A good opportunity to take a little bit back. We don't rise up and say, nah, enough already. And I wish, you know, when we talked with Rocky Anderson yesterday, I wish there was an opportunity in this country to have an honest third-party debate. I don't think it's going to ever happen in my lifetime. I'm hoping it does. I would love to see it. I would love to see a third party emerge. But I think it's only possible with instant runoff voting, which, you know, I can vote my conscience and not have my vote not count. You know, and there are states across this country that do it, that mandate every election must be won by 50% plus one. And I think that's something that needs to be done on the national level. Every election has to be won by 50% plus one. So that you take 2000, for instance. When Ralph Nader was in the race and he siphoned some votes away from whoever, and Buchanan siphoned some votes from whoever. You decide, I'm not going to get down that whole road. We know the history. We know Gore won. You know it. But had you had instant runoff voting, you could have voted for Nader or Buchanan or Mickey Mouse for your first choice and not thrown your vote away. I said, my first choice is Ralph Nader or Mickey Mouse or, you know, the Tom Corbett Space Cadet. And then my second choice is either Bush or Gore. And if your first choice didn't get, if they didn't 50%, you threw out your first choice because those people were taken off the ballot. And you went to your second choice. Your vote now counts. And I think that's what's important. But the hope is, and I'm... You know, I guess I'm the ever optimist that this election cycle is going to be about real issues, not the stuff that we've been thrown at. You know, my wife told me today that, you know, all of her relatives, you know, they are the Republicans. They're just all over the map. They're so diverse in their ideas, and there's no one who's going to unite the Republican Party. And I'm going, really? They believe that? Because I don't see much difference. They seem the same to me. A couple of the little social things that have been blown out of proportion. The Santorum campaign. Okay, I can see a little minor crack. Just a little something. But for the most part, they're all the same. Which is why you don't see other people on the stage. And I point to Buddy Romer, who actually got some votes. Did pretty well for somebody nobody knew and had no money. I'm in favor of having more people involved. But I look at this article, and again, it kind of makes me chuckle that they go to an investment banker as their female working person. And they go to a temp agency to find their workers. Kind of tells you the diligence and the investigatory abilities of today's print media. Or is it just that's what the editors wanted? Is that the message they were sending today? Because understand, what we see, what we hear, what we read, the vast majority of it controlled by a very, very small number. Five, six companies maybe.
They've got the drum. It's up to us to stop listening to their drum. You look at conservative talk radio, 91%, I saw a study, 91% of all talk radio is right-wing drum beat. They're all the same. There's no diversity among them. They all preach the same underlying message. There may be some personality differences, but it's the same message. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, some news from the city of D.C. with Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Back after this.
America. Rick Smith.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
Wednesday, January 4th, the Earth will be closest to the Sun for the year this evening, according to clocks in the U.S.
For the whole world, Earth's closest point to the Sun, called its perihelion, will come at 1 in the morning Universal Time on January 5th. Earth comes closest to the Sun every year in January during winter for the Northern Hemisphere. We're always farthest from the Sun in July during Northern Hemisphere summer.
So you can see it can't be Earth's distance from the Sun that causes the seasons. In fact, our planet has seasons because of its tilt on its axis. Earth's tilt causes the northern and southern hemispheres to trade places in receiving the Sun's light and warmth most directly as our world orbits the Sun.
Earth's closest and farthest points to the Sun don't cause the seasons, but they do affect the lengths of the seasons. When Earth is closest to the Sun for the year, as it is now, our world is moving fastest in orbit. The result is that Northern Hemisphere winters and Southern Hemisphere summers are the year's shortest seasons.
So that's our planet Earth closest to the Sun in 2012 on January 5th at hour number one, Universal Time. I'm Deborah Bird.
And I'm Jorge Salazar. Come to the Tonight area of EarthSky.org for sky charts. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
The most important issues of the day. This is The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at TheRickSmithShow.com. I guess it's all over. The whole presidential thing is over, and we just don't know it. According to Pat Robertson, he knows. He was praying over it, and God told him. You know, it's... He knows who it is, but he's got to keep it secret. Got to keep us in the dark for a little longer. He'll tell us eventually when he thinks it's right. And you know, he's talked to God, and God told him that the economy is going to collapse, and it's not him doing it. So don't blame God when everything goes to hell. I guess that's the Pat Robertson view. Wow. Scary, scary stuff. Anyway, to find out what's going on in Washington, D.C., our good friend Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, thanks for taking time for me.
Well, thank you so much.
So what's going on? I guess the Iowa thing, a little fallout?
A lot of fallout. A lot of things happened today, really. I mean, the first thing that happened, of course, today, because it didn't happen until 2:30 this morning, was that the results were announced and, you know, 8 votes. Da, da, da.
Landslide.
Yeah, huge. And actually, I think it was only a 66 vote difference, something like that, between what Mitt Romney got before last time and what he got this time, which is not actually huge.
Right.
So he really didn't make any inroads yep. which is very interesting. Rick Santorum, on the other hand, did surge and did very well indeed. And this despite the fact he didn't even have a bus until last week when he got one from a reality TV star. So, you know, he did very well. Of course, now he comes under scrutiny, and a number of his really very controversial positions and statements will come under scrutiny too. But he's done well. So that was interesting. Then Ron Paul in third place. He's quite pleased with that, and he will go on to New Hampshire, where he expects to do well, where there are independents who will vote for him, you know, and yep. There are obviously Republicans who are likely to vote for him as well. So he will probably do pretty well there. However, Newt Gingrich, interestingly, there was this Insider Advantage poll that I sent you in my email that came out on Monday. The time in fourth place was 16%. He got 13%. In one day, he dropped 3 percentage points. That's a lot.
Wow. Well, I mean, at the end
of... Not a good showing.
No, and you knew Gingrich wasn't. I mean, if the state, as you know, has been reported, is as evangelical and as religious as you would believe, a serial adulterer not going to do well there.
No, and yet, you know, you listen to a lot of people, and it's so interesting. So many of them seem to be willing to put that to the side.
Well, because there's that black guy in the White House.
Right.
I mean, and to me, I got to be honest, to me, that's a big part of it, I think. You know, when I heard Rick Santorum the other day say that he doesn't want to make black people's lives better, he doesn't want to extend Medicaid to them, in the probably one of the whitest states in the country, tells me that's, you know, that's dog whistle politics. He's sending out the buzzword because the vast majority of people on Medicaid in Iowa have to be white, don't they?
I guess.
I mean, if they're 91%. I would assume the vast majority have to be somewhat white, don't you think?
I would think so, probably right.
Seems reasonable. And also he came out and said that he would be in favor of letting states outlaw birth control. So good for him.
A birth control between married people.
Yeah, isn't that beautiful?
It's interesting, isn't it?
And it goes back to what I've said for years, is that it's really not about Roe versus Wade. It's about Griswold, which is, you know, I guess that must have been such a relief for him to come out and say.
Yeah.
So when we go to New Hampshire now, you're going to be in New Hampshire, right?
I'm going to be there, baby.
Looking forward to meeting you. Last time we missed each other on the sitting at the very next table, but I will make it a point to hunt you out. I guess that doesn't sound well, does it? But here's the thing.
Yeah, it didn't sound right somehow.
No, it didn't.
It just sounded slightly off.
Yeah, maybe I shouldn't. But where do you think this is all going to go? I mean, I think Romney's the guy there especially, and I don't think anybody else is going to really stand much of a chance.
Well, this is the thing, and particularly with Rick Perry saying that he's in it rather than getting out, I think that's the problem, because he splits the conservative vote. That's the problem. He splits the conservative vote. And so it makes it easier for Romney.
Okay, even after his goofy speech that he did up there some time ago, where maybe he was drugged, maybe he was drunk, or maybe he was just feeling a little silly.
I don't think it matters. You know, I don't think it matters. I mean, it's Romney's to lose.
Right. And that's pretty much where it is. And, you know, I've been saying for the longest time they're all the same, which is little variances here and there. But where it matters, you know, doing away with Social Security and Medicare and taking care of business, they're all the same. Let's talk about the big spinal transplant that happened today. And I've been saying that Obama stole Bachman's titanium spine since she wasn't using it. Recess appointments.
Yeah, this was really very, very interesting. The president had signaled, we were getting rumors of this, I reported this yesterday, it came through the Wall Street Journal and a few other outlets, but a lot of the big papers didn't pick it up. He announced today his intent to recess appoint four individuals, not one, to fill key in administration posts. Richard Cordray, director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and Sharon Block is a member of the National Labor Relations Board. She is the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Congressional Affairs at the Department of Labor. She's also worked for Senator Ted Kennedy in the past. And also Terrence Griffin, to be a member of the National Labor Relations Board. He's Deputy Assistant Secretary of Congressional Affairs of the Department of Labor.
I think
he's a Republican.
Yep.
And Richard Griffin to be a member of the National Labor Relations Board. And he's a chief counsel to NLRB board member Brian Hayes. He's general counsel for the International Union of Operating Engineers.
Right.
So I think he might be a Democrat.
Or he may be a labor guy, not necessarily a Democrat.
But I think he's a labor guy.
That's right. And that's what
you want.
You want a career person. You want somebody who's actually had boots on the ground. I think they were a reasonable assortment of people to put on the board.
Well, I think many people thought they were a reasonable assortment, but I think what happened was that there were some who really wanted the National Labor Relations Board to become completely ineffective when the current person on the board, whose name is escaping me, has to leave at the end of his term, which will get the numbers too low for them to be able to do anything.
Right. Well, the whole idea was to neuter it and to take workers' rights away and make sure that there was no place to go to get your rights, but make sure all the laws were on the books so that they could use against you. I mean, that's the whole idea.
So what the president said is that the American people deserve to have qualified public servants fighting for them every day, whether it's to enforce new consumer protections or uphold the rights of working Americans. We can't wait to act to strengthen the economy and restore security for our middle class and those trying to get in it. And that's why I'm proud to appoint these fine individuals to get to work for the American people.
And I'm looking for. I wish he would have appointed about 100 more people today. Maybe fill a lot of those judicial posts that have been vacant because the Republicans have blocked every nomination that he's tried to make.
There's always tomorrow.
Well, I'm hoping the guy gets a spine. I mean, I'm hoping he stole that titanium spine and he uses it.
I mean, you know, the fact is that because he's not doing this during one of those blink moments in between sessions of Congress, because he's saying, I don't recognize the recess, unless they come hurtling back like buffalo and get back into session. And I don't see Harry Reid saying, yeah, we all need to come back now.
Yeah, I don't see that happening either.
I don't think that's going to happen. He's just going to continue doing it.
Is that the sense you're getting, that he's going to start recess appointing people, a bunch of them? Because I got to be honest. You know, I'm looking at the numbers. He's recessed, 29, I think 32 now, if you can, the three at the NLRB, so 32 people.
I don't think he's going to go hog wild. I don't think he's going to just go absolutely balmy, ballistic, and crazy. I think these four are enough to cause conniption fits.
Oh, yes,
up and down the cloakrooms of the Senate. But it wouldn't surprise me if we see one or two judicial nominees, one or two uncontroversial people. I don't know, maybe there's somebody in the printing office he might want to get, you know, in.
Yeah, because you're always going to need printing done.
Yeah. Maybe somebody in some postal service somewhere he's trying to get in. I mean, not the postal service, the laying people off. I was just giving an example of somebody fairly non-controversial. But I think there is somebody in the printing office, something like that, who can't get in.
That's amazing to me. And lastly, you've got written here, a German train company is lobbying for a law to sue a French train company?
Yeah, this is a fascinating story that I sent out this morning. Germany's National Railway has hired a firm to lobby Congress on legislation that could clear the way for lawsuits from Holocaust survivors. So Deutsche Bahn AG, which is wholly owned by the German government, has got a lobbying company on the Hill now. And they're working on the Holocaust Rails Justice Act. And there's two bills, one in the House, one in the Senate. And it would allow U.S. district courts to hear civil cases against foreign national railways for their role in moving victims to concentration camps. And the legislation explicitly targets SNCF, which is France's government-owned train company. Now, why is that? Well, because SNCF, which is protected from lawsuits in the U.S. by foreign sovereign immunity, was sued by Holocaust survivors in the U.S., and the rail company, according to House Foreign Affairs Committee Chair Representative Ileana Ross-Leighton, hid behind sovereign immunity so it couldn't get sued, also claims that its officials were forced to do the things they did, and yet they haven't contributed to post-war reparations of victims. And also, apparently, they are hopeful of winning rail contracts in the U.S.
Ah, and there's the underlying.
There's the underlying, which I left for last because I thought it would be good.
Amazing. Well, I mean, you know, and I'm sure we'll pass it.
Oh, I think it'll pass. And isn't it interesting that it's the German government that's going after them?
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, jeez. Victoria, always great talking with you.
Good to talk to you.
Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Let's take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. For working people, come to talk.
Together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
In 1897, miners at collieries throughout northeastern Pennsylvania's anthracite coal region had had enough. Conditions were grueling and life was difficult. Miners were frequently cheated out of pay, overcharged for supplies, some they never wanted or received, forced to live in captive company-owned towns, shop at overpriced company-owned stores, even mandated to use the company doctor since fees were deducted automatically from the miner's pay. This, combined with mine owners forcing longer unpaid hours and the anti-immigrant Campbell Act of 1897, taxing mine owners for the use of non-native labor, drove miners to strike. Spontaneously starting in Pennsylvania's Lehigh Valley, workers marched north to get other miners to join in the struggle. Their demands were modest, a 10-cent pay raise and a reduction in the cost of gunpowder. They also wanted the freedom to shop in non-company-owned stores of their choosing and see a doctor not owned by the coal company. As the miners moved northward toward Hazleton, mine owners, determined to crush the workers' protest, sent their company-paid police force and strike breakers. Local law enforcement was also on the side of mine owners. Luzerne County Sheriff James Martin, a former mine foreman, deputized 102 local men, arming them with Winchester rifles and sidearms. The group of some 400 miners marching peacefully and unarmed in rows of fours moved onward toward Latimer. Stephen Urich, joining the group outside of Hazleton, taking with him the American flag, shouted, "We have nothing to worry about because we have the American flag to protect us." Within hours, in a hail of Winchester bullets, Stephen Urich was gunned down in cold blood, his beloved American flag drenched in his blood and the blood of those who lay murdered and wounded. Eyewitnesses said the sheriff and his hired killers mowed the men down like grass. More than 20 men were murdered on that September day, and more than 50 were wounded, many shot in the back in labor's forgotten massacre. The sheriff and his murderous band were tried for their part in the Latimer massacre and found not guilty of murdering 20 unarmed peaceful demonstrators. Lest we never forget, or as the wife of a miner whose life was stolen from him told her children, "You can forgive, but you can't forget." This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.ricksmithshow.com.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Well, I know that somewhere down inside there's feeling small and scared. And they need to know that someone out there cares. Have you heard a Republican today? Have you tried to spread your love to those who love the NRA? Though they might be quite reluctant cause they'll wonder if you're gay.
Yeah, give him a good big old bear hug, and then watch him shoot you. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. Missed any portion of our program, you can download our podcast there at the website. Or if you've got the Stitcher app on your smartphone, you can take a class war on the go. The Borowitz Report, a report from Andy Borowitz. Former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney was overjoyed today after finishing the Iowa caucuses in a virtual tie with a walking joke who wears a sweater vest. Romney exclaimed to supporters of the 0.0006% margin of victory, "The eight people have spoken." The former Massachusetts governor put the best face on the razor-thin lead, telling supporters, "Say what you will, but eight votes is still six more than Rick Perry can count." So, yeah, funny. Historians noted that the last time so few people decided a presidential race, they were all on the Supreme Court. As for other candidates, runner-up Rick Santorum said that he had received a phone call from President Obama. He stopped laughing just long enough to say congratulations, according to Santorum. And former House Speaker Newt Gingrich addressed speculation about whether he would leave the race by saying, "Well, not unless it gets cancer." So there you go. That's kind of funny if you think about it, not unless it gets cancer, because that's when he left his one of his wives. So there's the inside joke. But I was looking at one of the clips, Pat Robertson, who I cannot believe anybody pays any attention to, and I really don't think they do. I think it's one of those, let's see what kind of crazy stuff comes out of the old guy, the old codger's mouth today. And he did not disappoint today. Listen to this. I mean, I
spent the better part of a week in prayer and just saying, "God, show me something." And I'll share with you some things I'll share with you. I think he showed me about the next president, but I'm not supposed to talk about that, so I'll leave you in the dark.
God told him who the next president is, but he's not supposed to tell you. So he's going to leave you in the dark. Scary.
Probably just as well, but I think I know who it's going to be.
He thinks he knows.
I'm going to read just what I wrote down, as if I'm hearing from the Lord these words. "Your country will be torn apart by internal stress. A house divided cannot stand.
God said
your president holds a radical view of the direction of your country, which is at odds with the majority. Expect chaos and paralysis. Your president holds a view which is at the odds with the majority. It's a radical view of the future of the country, and so that's why we're having this division."
And that's what God told him. And I, you know, there's part of me that goes, God's a capitalist? Really? I mean, because his kid, not so much. And I guess maybe that's, there's part of me that goes, maybe that's the whole reason that God allowed him to be crucified. Kind of fell away from the tree, maybe. I mean, really, stop and think about it. God told him. So he knows, but he's not going to share it with the rest of us. I mean, that's kind of scary when you think about it. But this apocalyptic, this is the end of the world, you know, hey, it's chaos. And he goes on later to say that, you know, the economy is going to collapse. But God wants us to know that it's not him that's doing it. It's us. We're doing it to ourselves. Because he would never want that. And I'm just kind of scared that this guy speaks to millions of people, evidently. Now, I look at Mike Huckabee, who another godly figure, if you will, former pastor. He's saying, look, there's some crazy things going on with the Republicans. They seem to be more interested in defeating Obama than they are in fixing the country, in rebuilding the country. And what was interesting, you know, he says that, you know, he's not sure who he'd pull the lever for. He says, you know, it appears to me, and it still does to a large degree, that many Republicans are more interested in just defeating Obama than they are in rebuilding America. He says, you know, I don't know who I'd vote for. He said he wants to see more emphasis on getting America back to work. He went on to say, defeating somebody without a plan to resolve a problem to me is a worthless endeavor. I mean, that's pretty strong indictment of Snow White and all of the dwarfs there. Now, Snow White has dropped out, and Rick Perry, I guess, was going to reassess, but I guess he's staying in now. So I guess he's going to be in and out, kind of like the closet. So there you go. And, you know, and talking about Huckabee, and there's part of me that thinks, you know, Huckabee's got some ambition in all of this. There's part of me that thinks that, who knows, down the road, does he pop his head up to say, hey, well, what about me? He came out and said that these super PACs are one of the worst things that have ever happened to American politics, and I agree with him. He says the rise in independent expenditure groups that don't have any accountability, that's dangerous. And he says, he reiterates what I've been saying all along. If you don't know where the money's coming from, if you don't know who's behind the message, who do you hold accountable? Who is it that you, when they're wrong, who is it that you blame? And I wish, and I'm hoping Obama makes that a central tenet of his reelection campaign, saying, look, we're going to spend $1 billion on a presidential election. We got to get the money out of this. And you look at this new report from the World Bank economist Branko Milovoj. Half of the world's richest 1%, half of the 1% in this world, about 29 million people, are Americans. Half. And you go, you look around the world and you go, well, people are looking to us with a jaundiced eye. The money concentrated in the hands of the very powerful handful. It's scary stuff. Now, the rest of the money, according to the report, is scattered throughout Europe, Latin America, and a few Asian countries. The report goes on to say the top 1% in terms of world earners, a household would need to make just $34,000 per person. So a family of four would need to make $136,000, which is, wow. That's in world terms, that's not in U.S. terms. And I go back to this idea that I've been talking about for some time now. You know, this idea of, you know, how can you have liberty? How can you have democracy? How can you have justice in a nation where you have this mass consolidation, this mass accumulation of wealth in the hands of such a few, and the few deciding what goes on? I mean, you look at Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, all funded from the wealth class. And while they have their little tiny differences, you got Santorum who's on the abortion kick, and really they, most of them are to one degree or another, they are all on board with big tax cuts for the wealthy, with tax cuts for corporations. They're all on board for changing Medicare so that, well, let's voucherize it or let's privatize it. Let's profitize it. Let's see how our cronies can make money off of it. They want cuts to Social Security, all of them across the board. Today, Obama appointed Richard Cordray to the head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. They all want to do away with it. They all want to repeal the Dodd-Frank bill. Do away with it all. They all want to end the Buffett rule. And the Buffett rule is pretty simple. Warren Buffett, who is a billionaire, or any gambler on Wall Street, or any CEO, should at least pay the same tax rate that the guy who cleans the toilet in the restroom where they go. At least the same tax rate. At the bare minimums. And they're against that. All of them, except Huntsman, are against, you know, ending tax breaks for these big oil companies. All of them, except Huntsman, are against ending the tax credit to ship our jobs overseas. At some point, you got to wake up to the realization the Republicans are all the same, and a lot of Democrats are with them on some of these issues. We need to get to the bottom. We need to get people who are going to stand up and fight for you and me. Not the corporations, not the wealthy, you and me. And you see that down in Texas, supporters of Donald Trump, I guess, have filed paperwork for a third-party potential run for him. And he says he's ready to go. He's ready to run. He called the draft effort a beautiful thing. You don't think he's paying for it? You don't think he's behind it? He, my friends, not the kind of third party we need. And for me, like the ad from the people over at Organizing for America put out in Iowa, when Republicans leave Iowa or New Hampshire or South Carolina or wherever they go, they're going to still leave behind the same bad policy, the same failed ideas, and tons of dissension. That's what they do. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com, that's where you go to get it. You can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. I do answer all emails personally. Have a great night. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide flood beneath the sway. Imperial mysterious.